Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 394 of the Roguecast, recorded November 22nd, 2022. Robot Domination.
All right, we are back with another podcast. We skipped last week because of craziness.
And we're back for Thanksgiving week.
We are getting to crazy busy time, so if a podcast doesn't appear one week, that probably just means we're too busy to podcast.
Yeah, just brace for it. We're going to still try and do it if we can manage it.
But
because we like doing these.
We do. But our money does not come from podcasting. It comes from selling stuff.
I guess. You know what people can do? They can come out to this store, buy stuff, yep. Help the store. We'll make witty banter like yep. We do on the podcast.
You know
extremely
it.
Witty.
Yep.
And
very
witty. It's like living the podcast.
It
then.
Is.
Just ask us what video game or movie we're watching, and you'll get the full experience.
Come see what happens in Roguecast Live.
There was considerably more nudity than I expected. And so, that's why I don't shop there anymore.
Rogue Comics, games, and surprising nudity.
But you know, in not podcasting last week, we weren't able to talk about Wakanda Forever. That was like maybe the biggest omission.
Yep.
Along with so it was sad news because comic creators keep dying.
Yes.
But we'll talk about catch up on that today. And
we're going to catch up. We're going to talk about Wakanda Forever. We'll give you a big spoiler warning.
Yep. So don't panic.
We're also going to talk about Deep Space Nine that I've been watching season one. So a little bit older.
Yep.
Like 30 years older.
Those weeks that you don't hear us, those were the weeks that we carried you.
Yes, those were the weeks. Those are the weeks I was watching Deep Space Nine.
That was the week as the parable says, when Randy was watching Deep Space Nine.
Yes.
But this is cool. I am watching Deep Space Nine and am closing in on the end of it. Might, before this year is out, actually reach the end of it. And you're watching the first season. But it's a fun show to discuss.
Yeah.
I've actually been busting to talk about a lot of the stuff. Outside of my podcast, because, you know, sometimes I don't want to talk about it with someone as nerdy as my co-podcaster father.
I understand. You want to speak different kind of nerds.
Yeah, I need somebody with less Star Trek knowledge that I can impress.
Yes, well, it's definitely me.
I watched Deep Space Nine, and I probably never will.
You need to get to it because it's the best.
You didn't even want to read the Star Trek comic because it might have Deep Space Nine finale spoilers.
That's true. And I already kind of vaguely know those spoilers, yep. But I don't want them to become set in stone in my head.
Right. All right, so store news. The big news, of course, Black Friday sale will be going on this week.
Yes.
Reminder that basically if you spend $25, you get a free blind bag of dice. You can use a stocking stiffer or a little gift to yourself. And for every $50 you spend, you get a $10 Albert coin you can either give away or, again, use for yourself.
People who've listened for any length of time probably know what the Albert coin is. But in case you're like, what is the Owlbear currency? What country do I have to go to? Do I go to Owlbear land?
You come to the country of Rogues Gallery. We are printing our own money now.
Yes.
It's true.
Well, now that we're a sovereign nation.
Yes.
Owlbear is, of course, being the classic D&D monster that we have been associated with for some years now. We have very cool gift certificate coins in that denomination. They look so cool. We have a TikTok. Go on our TikTok and watch the TikTok I made like 6 months ago for
them. And then watch the TikTok with Nightwing's butt.
Yes, that's true. These are the early TikToks I made that was really quality material, I think.
Sure.
Slightly overlooked by you, the audience. But anyway, yes, so we're doing those cool Owlbear coins. They are really fun.
We also have right now a sale on Frameworks minis, the ones that are on sprues, the ones you have to cut together and paint and glue, but they have different weapons.
Right. It is the it is all the quality of the WizKids minis, but I mean, it's the same people who make them.
I was going to say, it is WizKids minis.
But, they're customizable.
Yeah.
And that was actually the only reason why they didn't, take off big time, I think, was actually that there's a little bit more involved. But this is also kind of a very cool gift-type item because, you know, you can, you know, pick and choose weapons, you know, facial expressions, with or without helmet, that kind of thing. So I feel like these are good gifts, and the fact that they're on sale, like an ideal holiday kind of thing.
Yeah, we're selling all the standard ones for $10 a piece, and we're going to do the bigger ones on Black Friday for 50% off.
Right.
We also have a new White Elephant gifts. We've taken a handful, I want to say about 15 board games.
Yep.
They originally retail somewhere between $30 and $40. We have wrapped them with holiday wrapping paper. If I say we, I mean it was John that did it.
He did a very good job.
Very good, better than I would have done. Mine would look janky.
Yeah, mine too.
So you will get, for $20, you'll get a pre-wrapped present you can just give out to a White Elephant or or an office party.
Yep.
You know, you get those things where it's like $20 and under, you got to $20 and under. You don't have to think about it, you just buy a game, They're good games.
Yeah.
And you're getting it at like half price.
Yep. And you'll be done in about 1 minute.
Yep.
And you can go home and do whatever it is you want with your
You can
cut.
Run in here like Homer on Valentine's Day going to Apu and be like, I need a white elephant gift, and we'll be like, right here, here you go.
That's right. Then you go home and play God of War.
Yes. Sure. All right. There were some board games that came in. We've got the new AEG game Verdant, which you're trying to build like a forest. Looks cool. We've got the new AEG game That Old Wallpaper, where it's a pattern matching. You're trying to match the like wallpaper patterns, which is really cool. We have.
If they don't do a horror version that has the yellow wallpaper, then I don't know what they're even doing.
We have a more extended game called Oak that I saw played at BGG last week. That is a sort of resource builder. It looks very, very pretty. It just came off Kickstarter. There is the Super Skill Pinball, which we got the Christmas one. We talked about it last time. But we had missed the Star Trek one.
Yeah, these are doing well for us.
A little Roll and Writes, where it simulates a pinball game. The Star Trek one has a Lower Decks, a Starfleet Academy, a original series of the Tribbles.
Yep.
And then a like another Next Gen. Oh, the Borg one. The Borg Resistance one. Yeah.
And I need to try one of these at some point because... You know, it seems like such a weird thing. It's like, why, you know, how do you get any of the fun of a pinball game, you know, in a board game? And but I've heard it described, and it sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, they really work.
I know it's not literally like trying to simulate like the exact pleasures of the twitch of a pinball thing.
But it's very similar, like trying to hit the patterns and that kind of thing. It really works.
Yep.
We got new Marvel Champions. They're still expanding their X-Men, so we got Storm, Wolverine, and Mojo.
Yep.
And then we got another game called Sky Mines, which looked really cool, where you're basically you're mining in space.
Oh, Sky Mines, not Sky Mines.
Mines with an E.
Got it. Mimes.
Sky Mimes.
Ironically, you heard the mimes.
All right, let's move on to the news, and let's talk about all the people who died.
Let's hit the sadness.
Yeah, like, man, It was brutal. So
this is covering about 2 weeks again since we took a little time off, but a lot of people.
So I think the first one we heard was Kevin O'Neill.
Right. Kevin O'Neill is not always a super well-known artist, but League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is probably his most well-known project, and he's like worked on all of those. I think
for me it was
Martial
Law.
I was going to say Martial Law is the one I know him from too.
Right. I'm just like saying that what the casual person is going to know him from. But didn't he work on every League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
Yes.
It was his.
It's his book with Alan Moore.
Yeah.
But yeah, Martial Law was one of those big sort of subversive
Judge Dredd type.
Yeah, it was like Judge Dredd, but like a more kind of overt skewering of fascism.
Yeah.
Like, arguably, that is what Judge Dredd skewers too, but it kind of, like, celebrates it a little bit too.
Yeah.
It has fun with it. And Martial Law did too, but it was, like, more of a dark satire, I think, in a more overt way than Dredd was.
He had
what looked like a little bit like a... It's, like, almost like superhero German commandant look.
Yeah, with a little bondage mask.
Like a little zipper mask.
I believe, was that Rick Veitch that wrote that? Or no, it was Alan Grant.
It was Alan Grant.
But it had some of that Rick Veitch. It was basically sort of a weird, fetishistic superheroes. It had a great line, He was like an ex-superhero who had been disillusioned, and now he killed the renegade heroes.
Yeah.
This is before Garth Ennis did The Boys, by the way. This is in the same vein.
Yep.
And the line was, they say I don't pray for my enemies. That's not true. I do. I pray they go to hell. And it had this, like, big over-the-top look. All his guys were big and veiny, and kind of like his Mr. Hyde in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yeah.
Like, Kevin O'Neill had a very cool style. Reminded me of a lot of what Simon Bisley did.
To hear, by the way, I learned a little bit about Martial Law listening to Grant Morrison's book on superheroes. Mm-hmm. Oh, what was that called? I listened to the
audio.
Super Gods, yeah. Highly recommended, and his overview of Martial Law was a lot of fun. But he also, like, I feel like he was, like, he had an art style that didn't look like anybody else but him.
Yeah,
which is a pretty rare thing. He was really very unique looking. But he also could do these, like, rather detailed cityscapes and things like that. You know, when I think of, like, the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, I think of, like, the Nautilus.
Yeah,
you know,
his Nautilus design was great.
Amazing design work. Definitely one of these guys, you know, who was great at drawing weird kind of Victorian settings and things like that. A great cult artist, I think. And, you know, really a peak craftsman.
And in his obituaries, or several stories I saw people telling, was the one that basically, he was, I think, the only artist that had been banned by the Comics Code.
Oh, God.
Like, the Comics Code, they got his stuff, and then they were like, They're like, yeah, we can't publish this. And he's like, well, what's wrong with it? It's like, we just don't like it. Like, it was too weird for them, too visceral, and they didn't like it.
Sorry, fellas, you're just too darn loud.
He was doing, like, horrific stuff for Alan Moore's Swamp Thing or something. It was, like, drawing these demons, and they... Oh, it's this Green Lantern story.
Oh.
That he did. He had these weird aliens, these weird, like, demonic aliens, and it was too demonic, and they did... It was off-putting. It was, like, Lovecraftian for them.
Was that in one of those ones that set up, like, the... Was it East Malt or whatever?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. That I didn't realize that was Kevin O'Neill, but yeah, I know he's been working with Alan Moore since forever. So
and he was very sense. He was very proud of this.
That I bet he was. Yeah,
they told him no. And then we lost another artist, Carlos Pacheco.
Pacheco looks, you know what, he felt like the heir apparent to me on of Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
I was going
to
make the same. Yeah, yeah.
And if you don't know that name. He was like the DC artist of the 70s, literally their kind of house style guy. But if you think of like all the merchandising, which he designed in like the 70s,
yeah.
Of Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Flash, that sort of unified look, not quite, I don't want to say Super Friends because like Super Friends' art wasn't that good.
Right.
But it kind of had that kind of classic DC look, sort of Silver Age-y, but he could draw like nobody's business.
He also reminded me of Stuart Immonen a little bit.
For sure.
But he did...
Yeah, let's talk about his projects.
So he did Avengers Forever with Kurt Busiek.
Mm-hmm. Big 12-issue miniseries.
And apparently he was very instrumental.
That was like one of the big Kang stories.
Yeah,
right?
Well, apparently Busiek was like... There was stuff where Busiek had ideas, and then Pacheco would throw in other stuff. So, like, there's the reason that, the Supreme Intelligence was so involved is because he had this image of him. And, like, there's moments that Pacheco basically added. Kurt Busiek talked about it. And Pacheco is very much a collaborator on the book.
I was going to say, it always seems like it's really good when the artists are excited enough about a project to bring something to the table. You know?
There's also the famous, he did the JLA-JSA graphic novel,
right.
Which had them sitting down for Thanksgiving dinner. You've probably seen that image of them, and that's a Pacheco image.
Right.
He worked with Johns on the relaunch of Green Lantern for a while.
I believe that's correct, yeah.
Yeah. He was he drew...
first
maybe
six
the
issues?
First, at least the first six issues, and he might have guessed a little bit after that.
And
he did, and also with Busiek, he did
Aerosmith.
For Aerosmith. That is not Aerosmith the band, but Arrow, right. Like an arrow you fire from a bow. But that was his. It's an alternate timeline, World War One, with like magic,
right?
Stuff like a where magic and dragons are sort of like part of the part and parcel of the battlefield,
right?
A good opportunity, I think, for him to like do fantasy art and, you know, break away from just
doing
superhero
the new
stuff,
right?
What's that?
He was doing the new Aerosmith,
yeah, he
right?
and Busiek were collaborating again. By the way, I don't think we said it, but, like, what did these guys die of?
He
had ALS,
ALS
and, Kevin O'Neill, I think, cancer, right?
Yeah, well, Pacheco announced his retirement in September, so he knew...
It had to be on the horizon. Because he was not, like, he wasn't some old man artist. He was, like, 50s, maybe?
Yeah.
Something like that.
But he's still doing some covers recently too.
Yeah,
man, like for guy. Like Damage and Court.
His last cover is for Damage Control number 2.
Damage Control, yeah.
That was the Marvel thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who else
then,
we got?
Kevin Conroy died.
That's maybe for me personally the biggest.
This
of them.
This was the big one for me too.
And you know the Kevin Conroy was the voice of Batman on Batman the Animated Series. Various video games and some other projects as well, some other animated ones.
He has been voicing Batman for about 30 years.
And for a lot of us...
He is Batman.
He's Batman.
I mean, not just animated series, not just Justice League, but also like the Arkham Asylum games, which are totally different.
That's huge, yeah.
I mean, he voiced Bruce, the older Bruce Wayne in Batman Beyond, which means that that character is only Kevin Conroy.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, I mean, in the ways that Adam West was Batman for a long time,
yeah.
Conroy, I think, supplanted that.
Absolutely. And he's going to live on in that format.
Yeah.
He's like the closest thing there is to a universally beloved Batman. I did appreciate there was like a huge outpouring of fan love for him. And I know he also experienced it in his lifetime, which was the maybe the most important thing for me to for him. The same way that Mark Hamill, his co-star Batman, was permanently associated with the Joker. Both seem to be great guys. The Joker was in, like, one out of every 20 episodes or something. Kevin Conroy was in every episode.
Yeah.
I mean, his voice is so kind of in my head that's what I hear when I read Batman in comics.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
And I think that is very, very common thing for a lot of people. just in the last year or two, he published it. He did a story in DC's Pride hardcover special. I did not know he was gay.
I didn't either.
I think he led a private life. There was a great interview with him that I heard years ago. I almost skipped over it in Kevin Smith's Fat Man on Batman podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, you know, obviously this guy was on a great show, but I'm like, yeah, I don't have any particular interest in him. When I listened to it, it was actually one of my favorite ones of the whole run, and I highly recommend anybody who can find it listen to it. But even on that, I don't think it came up. I think he basically kept his personal life kind of quiet.
Yeah.
And so he talked about going, like, he went to Juilliard and stuff like that. But it was definitely, like, kind of a hard-fought thing. I think he had to get a scholarship. I don't think he didn't grow up with money. And I don't know a lot about his backstory, or I've kind of forgotten it, some of it. But he talks about it very eloquently in this special, in the Pride special, because he was growing up in, what, 70s and 80s, and he got tons of homophobic pushback.
Yeah.
He was kind of keeping it quiet, but it kept on resurfacing in his life. And what he does in the story is he equates his sort of, when they said, oh, hey, we're going to have you read for Batman. Mm-hmm. Here's a quick character sketch of him. He's a guy who's leads this secret life, and you know, he's got to internalize that, and it's kind of traumatic for him, and he's trying to do that. He's like, do you have anything that you can bring to that? And he's like, yes, I think I can.
Yeah.
And so he kind of like was able to, it seems like, turn this true life traumatic thing of growing up with the homophobia that was endemic to those eras, and still is, just in different ways.
No, we've totally solved it. Right?
He can he brought that to the character, and I think it's important for people to remember that they're, you know, the greatest Batman of all time is the gay actor Kevin Conroy.
So just to remind you, Batman's gay. It's canon now. Sorry.
Didn't DC make this one shot available on their website?
I think for they people did,
to,
yes.
Which
they
I thought was it, a yeah. really good thing to do.
You know, I thought that was the case because they were posting it, but then I looked in the comments and a lot of people were saying it was behind a paywall.
Oh, really?
And if it is behind a paywall, just look around. It's on a bunch of blogs and stuff. You can find the full thing.
DC may not have, but the fans have.
Yeah, yeah. Pirate it and just read the story if DC doesn't have it easily available. They may have changed it.
You're always advocating people to steal comics in this podcast. It's weird.
But yeah, Kevin Conroy was a big loss. But again, I can at least be happy for him that he was able to really see a lot of love, I think, for what he did before he died.
And then most recent, Green Power Ranger Jason David Frank died.
Yeah.
Jason David Frank, is that right?
Jason David Frank, yes.
Yeah. Now, I don't think any of us have ever met him or know him, but we are all friends with people who are, like, huge into the Super Sentai. And like,
yeah, basically, if you were a 90s kid,
yeah,
then the Power Rangers loomed large. And I think the Green Ranger seemed like he must have been, like, the coolest one since he started out.
Yeah, I mean,
he started out as a bad guy, right?
He did. I didn't watch much of Power Rangers, but what I did, Green Ranger was definitely the coolest.
But he was, he would go to conventions. He was, by all accounts, one of the nicest guys. Like, everybody, I had seen all my friends talk about, like, you know, he hung out for hours talking to fans, and, like, he was always a nice guy, and he became friendly with people who were just, like, just, you know, fans of the show.
That kind he's
of
like thing, a, he so. Was like an MMA guy, right?
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. So, had gone too soon. I think he was 49.
Yeah. I want to say that one has been kind of not talked about a lot, but I believe it was suicide.
Yeah,
pretty awful. And, you know, I don't know any of his specifics, but I do know that, like, you know, essentially the people who do sort of genre shows, cult shows like that, it can take its toll because sometimes you get typecast, sometimes you can never find more serious work. And then just also, like, the business can kind of eat you up.
Didn't he also do that Valiant thing where he was Rye?
Oh, I think he did, yeah.
Or was it, right. maybe not Rye, he was Ninjak.
Ninjak, yeah, you're right, Ninjak. Yeah, that's right, he did. You're right. Yeah. All right, moving on from the all the people who died.
Yeah.
Jason Blum and James Wan are in talk to merge their production companies.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I think I posted that link, but I have kind of forgotten the deal. Yeah, basically, I think people probably know Blumhouse Productions. They do tons and tons of horror movies, including some. I'm trying to think of, like, the biggest things that they've got. I mean, like, Insidious and Conjuring and stuff like that. Yeah. But did they also, like, do Get Out?
I feel like they were involved in Get Out, yeah.
I want to say maybe so. I feel like there's a few, like, the things that would now we would call it sometimes elevated horror. Yep. I know some people are like trying to turn away from that because it feels pretentious, but it sometimes it just means that the horror stuff that is pushing a little bit beyond the slash.
I mean, they did all the Halloweens, they did Black Phone, they did Happy Death Day, yep. Purge.
And James Wan was one of the guys who put him on the map.
Yep.
He did Saw, and he did Insidious, and he did Conjuring. And so they are going to do what now?
Merge their production companies. They're just in talks.
It seems like a natural.
If this gets us more Malignants and Megans, I'm all for it.
It's time to cut out the cancer.
Now this is just two powerhouses joining forces to create.
Yeah, they've already worked together.
Yeah, Jason Blum knows what he's doing. I mean, neither are dumb.
Speaking of people who don't know what they're doing, though, Sony has ordered some Spider-Man TV shows. They're doing a deal with Prime.
Okay.
Yes. So they're going to try and... Basically, Sony's going to try and duplicate what Disney Plus did.
Yeah.
Except that Disney Plus had a successful line of 22 films to base off of, and Sony has Venom.
You're forgetting Morbius.
I'm not. I promise I'm not.
Forgetting future Kraven movie.
So the first thing they're going to do, though, is Silk Spider Society. And what's interesting about this is it's Amy Kang, who I think did a bunch of the Walking Dead stuff.
Yeah.
This is Silk from Spider-Man.
Yep.
Sydney Moon.
Sydney Moon, she's the...
she got bit by the spider right after Peter.
She's Korean.
I think that is correct. Korean-American, yes.
Right, she was bit by the spider shortly after Peter Parker was, but then was kind of kept in a isolated vault or something like that because they knew she was going to be hunted by Morlun.
Yeah.
And eventually she gets out, and I guess it's just like the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt or whatever.
Yeah.
she's got to readjust to life in this crazy modern world.
She's a super proud mole woman.
Yes. Well, that's an interesting way to put it. But yes, and actually I think a very similar way to how they've done the Spider-Man spinoff movies like Morbius and Venom and stuff like that
uh-huh.
really don't have Spider-Man in them. It seems like they're kind of doing that with their animated thing, too, right?
Well, this isn't animated. This is live action.
Oh, it's live action.
Yeah.
For
Prime.
And I think when I read the synopsis of this somewhere, it did sound like it was going to be the same origin as the comics, like it was the same spider that bit Peter or whatever.
Except it won't be Peter, right? They don't ever reference Spider-Man in these things.
And maybe what is the deal? Why don't they do that?
They have the rights. Because they can.
They just don't want to muddy the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I think.
Well, that's Marvel not wanting Sony to do it.
Yeah, wouldn't Sony want to?
But Sony doesn't give a shit,
but
I think.
I don't think
at this point.
Sony's wanted to. I think Sony doesn't want to feel like they're standing on the shoulders of Marvel, and that's why they don't reference it.
Is this basically like what DC does with their television series where they don't reference Batman, even though they should?
They can, just... yes.
that said, I'm sure what they are hoping for is something of the quality of the sort of like the way Miles Morales took off in animation.
Yeah, yeah.
They would like to have this female version of Spider-Man, or at least it's Spider-Man inspired.
Yep.
And have her take off in live action. Amazon Prime, you said?
Yeah, Amazon Prime.
They've shown a capacity to do some good stuff, so it's not like without hope. It's just like you said, the apparatus, all the heavy lifting that had been done by the MCU for their stuff has not been done.
If they had said that they were going to do a Miles Morales live action, that would have caused a ripple.
Oh, that'd be excited about.
That'd honestly be excited. If Marvel had announced they were doing a Silk show, I'd be excited.
Yeah,
Sony doing it is okay.
You know what I wonder? I don't know what I know that there is a lot of interest in America right now in Korean TV and movies. There's a ton of stuff coming over.
Yeah.
I don't know if that goes the other way. Certainly, America is always a big cultural sort of pop cultural export, and I assume it is in Korea just the same. But I'm would a big budget Korean hero potentially be very big in Korea and it'd be a notable export there and a kind of a synergistic relationship? Like that could be a big thing if they pull it off.
Yeah. One last bit here,
but I don't think think it's real likely they'll pull it off.
No, not really.
Doctor Who has cast the companion for Nkuti Gatwa's Doctor.
Yep.
It is Millie Gibson. She's playing Ruby Sunday. Great name. She's best known for a British soap opera, but she's also been in some BBC dramas. She looks a little Rose Tyler-ish.
Yeah.
A little younger.
The picture's great, though.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm excited for this. And since it is now on Disney+, I will be able to watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I haven't watched Doctor Who in years, and I can't say I'm like particularly excited about the new one. The various reshufflings of Doctors doesn't particularly interest me.
Yeah.
Broadly, and I know the different showrunners and stuff give a different feel, but I just have to be in the mood for Doctor Who. Like when I am, I'm pretty charitable towards whatever its minor issues and things, or even major issues are sometimes. But it's been a little while. But I think, I wouldn't mind checking in on the Doctor. Yeah,
I'm probably going to.
I know that, like, sometimes I have loved the Doctor, so let's...
And the Doctor's loved you, Dave.
You know what? Good.
All right. That's our news of the week. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about comics for the last couple weeks. We're talking comics for the week of November 16th and November 23rd,
mm-hmm.
and let's dive right in because there's a bunch from the last couple weeks. I have sort of separated them out, but they're gonna it'd be a mix of stuff that comes out this week and stuff that came out last week.
So don't panic if you hear something that you didn't think was coming out this week. It could have been last week. Don't yell at us.
Right. all right. So I'm just gonna start from the top. Let's there's some Star Wars.
There are.
Yes. This one is, I believe. Star Wars Revelations, is that what it's called?
Star Wars Revelations.
And I believe it is kind of, you would might consider it the key, the...
It's the Rosetta Stone.
The Rosetta Stone is the word I was looking for, Randy, or Nick. The Rosetta Stone to the next year of Star Wars stories.
Yeah.
Now, they made it pretty clear in the solicit that it's not meant to be, it's not literally like just a bunch of previews, there's a story, and it has, I don't know, Randy, we talked about this, there's some kind of weird thing that allows Vader to perceive through it the past, present, and future...
Yes.
Of the setting. I know that he teams up with one of Padme's handmaidens from back in the day.
So the thing is, he goes to the Eye of Webbish Bog.
Okay.
Which I think, I'm not sure, because I have not, this is not since a wee child that I read this, but there was a famous Star Wars novel that came out between Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back. It was the only Star Wars thing. Yeah. It was called Splinter the Mind's Eye. And I believe it's like Leia wields a lightsaber and maybe the Force, and it was sort of non-canon, but is beloved, and I believe that there's a reference to it.
That is interesting, yeah, like an update of the eye.
But yeah, so...
But by giving you these glimpses of the future and telling a story with them, I believe you are seeing kind of a preview in some ways, even though it's not a literal preview,
yeah,
of what Marvel is doing with the Star Wars story. So I feel like all the Star Wars people are probably going to want
to check this out. Well, he touches on Star Wars, Dr. Aphra, Bounty Hunters, all the main Star Wars books.
Vader.
And then Vader, of course. Vader's like the lead of this. And then there is a... they talk about Hidden Empire, which I think is the current thing going, so...
Hidden Empire is like...
Han and Chewie is also mentioned, so.
I believe Hidden Empire is the one that's like the Empire versus the crime syndicates, which is pretty
Kira,
cool.
Yeah, it's
Kira, from... Yep. Yeah, Solo in her crime career. By the way, I think Empire versus crime syndicates is a cool story.
It is. So yeah, I think essentially this is the... If you want to see what's been going in the Star Wars, they're all hitting issue number 30, all the main books. This is like a, hey, check back in, and here's what we've been doing. Mm-hmm. You might be interested.
By the way, is that a Phil Noto cover?
I believe it is.
That's a nice cover.
It's a really nice cover. And then we've got Star Wars Yoda. We're getting a story of Yoda during the Jedi Council era. And I believe it is... He is flashing back in his memories. He's talking to a Force ghost in the Dagobah. And he flashes back to a mission when he was a council member and he went to a planet to help them. It's got really pretty art from Nico Leon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who we think might be the guy who did that Pride of Baghdad with...
His name was Nico something.
I think it might be. It's very, very pretty art.
It is. And it was a good story.
If you like Yoda, like he's got Yoda's character down. This is cool Yoda with
there's
a lightsaber.
Somebody doesn't like Yoda. I want to talk to him.
Well, felt very reminiscent of like early Clone Wars.
Okay.
Where he was going on missions.
The
and
more
stuff
active
like
Yoda.
Yeah, the more active Yoda. And there's just...
Back when he was merely like 783 or something.
Yes.
Not some old ass man of 800.
Not crazy, crazy man on Dagobah. Crazy trickster.
Beating up stuff with a stick.
Yes.
That was a genius idea.
It was.
Yes. Calling around really with his pet snake or his friend snake.
As seen on the toy.
Marvel has a new Doctor Strange book this week, written and drawn by Trad Moore. You might know from...
Silver Surfer Black.
Silver Surfer Black.
And or also,
the, what was the indie
Legend of Luther Strode.
Legend of Luther Strode.
Legend of Luther Strode. This guy is a very, very talented artist who is, I believe this is a one-shot, right?
Yeah, no, this is a miniseries, I think.
Yeah, it's a miniseries.
Okay.
Yeah. It is a weird, trippy Doctor Strange going through multiple dimensions. Very, very pretty book.
Yeah, I think people need to just go ahead and give this one a flip through.
Yeah, for sure. This is, I think, from last week. There's a one-shot spinning out of Avengers by Mark Russell, who has been hit or miss, but when he's a hit, he's really good. Artist named Dave Wachter, who...
Did you say what the name was?
Blade Vampire Nation.
It is Vampire Nation, right.
But I was talking about the creative team.
Oh, okay, people don't care about that until they hear the name of it.
Anyways, Blade Vampire Nation, to spoil all my setup. the artist by Dave Wachter, who looks very much... It's got a Mike Perkins, very pretty photoreal look to it.
Yeah, yeah, Mike Perkins did so is good for that kind of... I don't know, like, slightly grittier look.
But what's interesting is this is set in Vampirsk, a nation that Dracula has built in Russia for vampires.
I was not even fully aware that Dracula had returned as a force in the MCU.
This happened in Avengers,
this
right?
In Avengers. He did some kind of vampire story. Because Jason Aaron decided that Blade should be a vampire, or Blade should be an Avenger, which I don't like.
For people who don't know, Dracula in the 70s and I guess early 80s was, you know, a notable fictional character, even though he was, like, kind of on the periphery of all the Marvel stuff. But he, like, fought the X-Men and kicked their ass.
Yeah, he Storm his bride.
He made Storm his bride. And Bill Sienkiewicz drew both the issues with him in it. Like, they're good stuff.
Tomb of Dracula, the 1970s book, was a very big, big, big book.
Yep. And then, though, always what I thought was a very cool thing in continuity, one of the great accomplishments of Doctor Strange is he used the Montesi formula and destroyed, at the time, all the vampires on Earth.
But it got undone.
How
did that work?
You know what? I think decades went by.
Yeah, it was a while.
In comic terms, that's a long-ass time.
There were no vampires.
So I can allow them to bring Dracula back, and now, and I guess he's got his own, like, nation now, like a sovereign nation of all vampires?
Yes, but this story... He's got a council and all this kind of stuff. This story is like a mix of, like, vampiric politics and Blade, who is like his sheriff somehow.
They must have. I don't know the specifics, but I was
they
telling
don't like
Mr.
each
Nick,
other.
He must have worked out a deal, like, you know, you don't go outside your country, and I won't have to cut your throat.
Yeah, but Blade is like basically doing an investigation of there's an assassination attempt on Dracula, and he's looking in to see what happened. It's a really good little story, actually. I enjoyed it as a one shot. It's a weird status quo, but it kind of works. You don't have to for any other Avengers. Like I say, it's a really good art. I was very pleased with this one.
Mm, nice.
There's also a miniseries called Murder World Avengers by Jim Zub, who's currently doing Thunderbolts, who wrote... He's written a bunch of D&D comics. He's all over the place. Along with Ray Fox as his co-writer. And this is an idea he's had for like 8 years running. But basically, the quick pitch is... Murder World is not set up as an assassin thing. It is a people sort of opt into it, and they
think Squid Game style.
They 200 people, one survivor, battle royale style. Winner walks away with $100 million and a new life. Battle royale, Squid Games.
But you have to survive. And think if like some of the death trappy stuff in Squid Games had like some of Arcade's normal motifs for his death traps, like X-Men robots and stuff like that. It's kind of a cool idea.
And then there's like
a miniseries,
there's
right?
like a YouTuber who gets drawn into it, and it is a miniseries, yes. And in fact, I believe
Black Widow will play a role in next issue.
There's going to be Murder World Spider-Man, Murder World Wolverine, Murder World Moon Knight, and everything comes to a crashing climax with Murder World Game Over. So it's a series of one-shots.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. That's not the craziest format.
And Black Widow is going to be involved in the next one.
Alright.
Yeah. If you like Arcade, if you like Murder World, if you like murder.
If you like Squid Games.
Like Squid Games. This is one to read. There's a reason it's called The Avengers, but I don't want to spoil what it is, but it's kind of funny. If you're reading the Demon Wars series, they are currently doing a Civil War
thing. That's the Marvel Demon Wars thing.
Pete Momoko. Basically, she did the last one she did was an Iron Man, and it was basically, she's doing Civil War. So this one is Captain America and his version of their
right.
superhero
the samurai version of these things.
Very cool, very pretty. And if you've been digging that stuff, there's more of it. There's a new Captain America and the Winter Soldier special spinning out of Cap Sentinel of Liberty, which reveals a new bad guy organization that is sort of using the Winter Soldier, I think, against Cap.
Yeah, I have not read this, so I was not quite sure what the context was going to be.
And then a reprint of Ghost Rider Danny Ketch. This is the 1990 series.
Highly popular. Yep. Is there any among us who was not reading this at the time?
I mean, I love this first issue.
It's a pretty remarkable first issue because, man, first of all, great design work.
Mm-hmm.
The new Ghost Rider look and his bike looked badass.
Who was writing this at the time?
This is Howard Mackey.
That's right.
And Javier Soltero is an art.
And he had a bunch of new powers.
Mm-hmm.
They all got showcased, and in a lot of ways, it's a pretty ideal first issue.
Yeah.
Looking back, you're going to notice some 90s-isms.
Sure.
But
actually, still looking at it, this is solid art. His guy, I don't remember his name, Bloodthirst or something like that, is whatever the villain is. But there's like a vampire who's his new villain. There's a lot of interesting stuff in here.
Why are they reprinting this right now? What's going on in the Ghost Rider that they thought?
I don't know. I don't know why Danny Ketch now, but you know.
Maybe he'll show up somewhere.
It is a.
But if you missed it or have, you know, read it at the time, but you've lost it or whatever, just want to revisit it, it's the three issues, that kicked it off.
Honestly,
a pretty reasonable price.
It's kind of peak Ghost Rider. Like, this is what Ghost Rider does really well.
Yep.
Over at Image, we have a book from Lorenzo De Felici, who was the artist on Robert Kirkman's, one of his books. The
sci-fi-ish one?
Yeah, sci-fi. Not Our Limits, but something like that. You know what I'm talking about.
They go to that other dimension.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I can't remember the name of it.
That one.
And it's not anywhere in this book, which seems like bad marketing. But the book he's doing is called Chroma with a K. And basically, he's doing a sort of a black and white universe where there's spots of color. It's a really interesting looking. There's someone who's sort of bringing color. And he references in his piece at the back about he's been working as a colorist in the Italian market. He's very fascinated about what color does to things. He talks about Pleasantville, Schindler's List, Sin City, and The Wizard of Oz, ones that sort of use color as a narrative tool.
Yeah.
And he's doing that. This is sort of an other world. There's a couple of kids and there's
gorgeous
magic. It's very pretty. And sort of this weird high concept of color being used.
Oblivion song.
There it is.
An
interesting new book that definitely does. You sometimes you get stuff from writer artists, and it's like, oh, I don't think a regular writer would have thought to do this. An artist who is also a colorist is the only guy who would have thought of this concept.
Right. It's that thing where they may have well been laying out the page and changed the story on the fly to accommodate some cool design worker visual notion.
There's also a new creator. I don't know the name. I can't pronounce the name. It is from Image called Voyages. And
let's
it
give
looks
it a
like
shot.
It looks like a big sort of like sci-fi world buildy kind of thing. Very pretty artwork.
When you say sci-fi, are we talking post-apocalypse? Are we talking Star Trek? What are we talking?
A little more Star Wars-y, maybe. But also it's a little... You
what percentage of Mass Effect?
Remember the book Runners that we liked that was sort of Star Wars-y?
Yeah.
It's a little bit like that.
Yeah, and Runners was, by the way, kind of Firefly-y before Firefly, I think.
Yeah. For those who... we had to look this up before we started recording. There's a new comic, Kamen Rider 01 from Titan Comics. This is a guy who has an insect suit and a motorcycle.
But if you watch stuff like Power Rangers and sort of Japanese, that sort of Super Sentai... what's it called, Tamakatsu or something like that? It's basically their practical effects kind of adventure stories with lots of dudes in suits and big rubber monsters.
Yeah.
That one goes back to the 70s though.
Yeah.
Bug man on a motorcycle.
This the first issue. There's a lot of good action stuff, a lot of good designs. It looks pretty cool. I am not. This is one of those genres that I don't have a particular interest in. Just the Ultraman that Marvel did, which it's all well done. Like Power Rangers, not my thing. But
you've always hated Bugman on motorcycles.
I hate Bugman on motorcycles. But as I was flipping through it, it looks like a good version of that.
I can imagine some alternate world Randy that might have enjoyed this.
In Earth Alligator.
Yes.
I am a big fan of Bugman motorcyclists. I like them the way I like Hawkeye and Andor is my favorite show. Star Trek has a new book, Star Trek Resurgence. This is a tie-in to a video game, which, Dave, I think you said is sort of like Telltale Games version of Star Trek.
Yeah, basically. Anybody who knows the Telltale Games like Wolf Among Us and Walking Dead and all that stuff, they're going to do a Star Trek one like that. It's set I think roughly same era as maybe a little bit before Picard, more like when Star Trek Nemesis and stuff came out.
They're all wearing the looks like the Voyager Deep Space Nine era uniforms.
The last look that they had in those
uniforms are cool.
They are. It is a good look. I have not read this yet, but I'm going to check it out sometime soon because it is a game that I want to play. I think the idea of a talky, lots of moral decisions kind of Star Trek game that's not just a pew pew.
They're a science vessel called the USS Resolute, and perhaps of note, Dr. Leia Brahms, who was like a warp engineer and. Yeah.
Geordi's weird holodeck girlfriend. Crush. Little did she know.
She is one of their consulting people. She's not Starfleet, right? She's
Right. She works in like the Daystrom Institute.
She now works for the Zefram Cochrane Institute for Advanced Theoretical Physics.
Okay, sure.
This is a introduction to a new crew, and there's a new villain. Talarian worships. Talarian a thing?
Yes.
I don't know what they are.
I'm mixing them up with the...
Dave, show us your Tex-Trek knowledge.
With the Temerians, which are the guys who... Darmok and Jalad guys.
And the Temeranians were Starfire's people.
Yeah, it's getting a little bit hazy in there. I don't know who the Talarians are.
And the Talakan, who, of course, are Namor's people. Do you know what they call him?
Kul-Kul-Kan?
They call him Kul-Kul-Kan.
We really bonded with the trailer for Wakanda Forever, and specifically M'Baku's pronunciation of Kul Kul Khan.
Yes.
Kul Khan.
They call him.
Frank Miller is back in comics, as is Dan DiDio. You may greet this with good or bad news, but if you're a Frank Miller fan or a Dan DiDio fan, there are two books this week. One is called Ancient Enemies, and it is sort of a military sci-fi superhero book. Dan DiDio writes, artist is Greg Bayruth, maybe? Pretty solid looking art, and if you're looking for something in the sort of the alt superhero vein, it is a big first issue. And then a lesser known Frank Miller project, Ronin, which is a sort of futuristic samurai book with genetically engineered like superhero type stuff as well.
Yeah, I believe what happened in the original Ronin was a dude in actual samurai times gets like either reborn or transported into what would be kind of a cyberpunkish future in his quest to get revenge for his murdered master. So it did have like this sort of more serious Samurai Jack before Samurai Jack was around notion. And this is, a sequel of some sort.
This, I think, looks like maybe his daughter or a clone or something. And sure. Yeah, it is same kind of deal. A samurai, someone who's a samurai in the future.
But also I think it's like... Hypothetically, I think this would appeal to people who are looking for cyberpunky stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Image has a graphic novel, I Hate This Place, Volume 1. I don't know if we all finished reading this, but I think we all were enjoying it at one point or another. This is a weird, haunted house book. A
couple of, what, girlfriends?
Girlfriends, yeah.
Go there and... I forget, are they just trying to... Did they just buy it? Are they trying to get away from it
they
all?
They inherit a farmhouse.
Inherit it.
And then they find out that
it's this weird nexus of horror.
It attracts ghosts, aliens, and other supernatural beings.
It's a good concept.
Yeah. And it's really... I like the art a lot. And I like the characters. It's very fun and sort of wacky. And also scary. It was a good book. Also, the subtitle of it is, Fuck This Place.
Yeah.
And then, of course... From last week, we have the Batman Spawn hardcover.
Yep.
Which reprints both the Batman Spawn and the Spawn Batman from the 90s.
Right. Image put out one, DC put out the other. Yep. But this has them. I think, although they may have reprinted those individually once or twice, I don't think they've ever been reprinted at the same place.
They never had a trade, I don't think.
Yeah. And I think this is probably one of those things that, like, Image and DC are only going to be buddies for so long.
Yep.
So probably when this is gone, it's going to be gone. It is a prelude to there's going to be a third crossover this December, like 2-3 weeks.
In a couple weeks, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you want Batman Spawn, it's $20 for a hardcover, which is not a bad deal.
Yeah. And I don't know if you know this, but at some point, Batman throws a batarang right into Spawn's face.
Spoilers!
It's true, because it is like the last page.
It is literally the last page. Other stuff I read, that's on my list, She-Hulk, 8 Billion Genies, Daredevil and Parker Girls, which have all been in my... my rotation.
I need to catch up on Parker Girls.
I'm liking it. I've been kind of a Terry Moore resurgence, and want to go back and read all the ones I didn't read, like Echo and Serial, I think, and some other ones. Anything else?
The only ones I will mention are Nightwing.
We're down to one last Nightwing 98, but if you haven't been reading Nightwing, you should read Nightwing.
It's an exceptional issue.
It shouldn't be as good as it is because it has a version of, like, Batmite in it. Batmite,
great.
Which is, like, the goofiest little Silver Age throwback character that there could be. But Tom Taylor handles it really well.
By the way, we try to keep things pretty positive on this podcast.
Yeah.
I am so mad at DC that they cannot get Nightwing back into print. We would sell this every week. We would love to put it in people's hands, but the hardcover went out and has not been available, and they keep shipping the trade. It's like middle of next year now, so there's really no way for us to get Nightwing into your hands, and if you don't already have it, we're very frustrated by it, but you can jump in late and enjoy it.
Yeah.
You're just missing some of the backstory stuff, but it is really good. They're about to do issue 100. I have a feeling that might be something of a jumping on point. And, I mean, this is a beloved book. We all love it. Serena had not been reading it, but now she's on board.
Yep.
We're like, I think John doesn't read a ton of comics, but we have to drag him into it, like, Clockwork Orange style.
Serena was also, like, playing the new Arkham game. What's it called?
Gotham Knights,
that's right. Yeah. And such was her Nightwing fandom.
Yep.
And the only other book I will mention is last week was the second issue of Junkyard Joe, Jeff Johns and Gary Franks, sort of G.I. Robot story. This one zigs where I thought it would zag, and I kind of appreciate that, just because it keeps me guessing.
That. I like that.
But the artwork is... Gary Frank, I just think, is a very talented artist.
Also, you had in your stack, we mentioned the start of Dark Web.
Oh, yeah.
The Amazing Spider-Man, which is it's the prelude to...
Yep, the Madeline Pryor story.
It's going to team up Madeline Pryor and Ben...
Riley.
Madeline Pryor, a.k.a. Goblin Queen.
Yep, and Ben Riley, a.k.a. Cavern or something. Chasm is what he's called now.
Let's not bury the lead here. Does Goblin Queen still have her sexy costume?
I assume so. Why would you ever fix that costume?
You wouldn't. It's just because it's retro. It's almost like a 70s.
Retro and borderline sexist.
Yes. But you know what? She's an evil demonic temptress.
She's empowered.
And also extremely empowered.
Yes.
And if she were to capture me, I'd be like, I guess I'm helpless.
She would have to step on you, yes. Step on me, Goblin Queen.
And finally, Spider-Man can experience that,
Yes. At last, Spider-Man can be dominated by a Goblin Queen.
What if Spider-Man was dominated by a Goblin Queen.
All right, we're gonna take a break and then we're gonna come back and talk about some movies and TV and board game convention of all things. All right, so we are going to talk about Wakanda Forever, but we're gonna wait and do that toward the end of the show. We're gonna give you guys a big spoiler warning, so don't spoil anything because we want you to see it and enjoy it.
Yes.
So before that, I'm going to talk about one of the reasons we didn't podcast last week is that I was still recovering from BGGCon, which was the big Dallas board game con. That's Board Game Geek. I go there every year, except for when there's a pandemic, which hopefully will not be a thing.
We're all done with it.
Yeah.
We won.
I guess not one of the throes of a pandemic, because I've now been to two pandemic years of BGG, because we're still in it. But
you do what you can.
I play a bunch of games. Basically, BGG Con is at this hotel in Dallas. They have a BGG has a floating library they set up, which has basically all the every game you can imagine, as well as new games that have just come out or that were at the Essen Spiel show and haven't come out yet.
Mm-hmm.
They're on their way coming out. They've got Kickstarter games in there. So there's a big giant game library, every game you can imagine, and usually stuff I've not heard of. This year I was more on top of things than usual, but there were still a few things I had never heard of before. And I play a little mini game, which is, how many games can I play in a weekend?
It's a lot. I watched your posts about this.
So I got it on Tuesday night, and I happened to run into my friend Scott Morris, who is the marketing guy over at Lucky Duck Games. I've known him forever. He used to be an Austin guy. And as I'm pulling up at the hotel, I hear, hey, is that Randy Lander? And he is just coming back for dinner. So right after I get there, I've just checked in my room, we sat down to play Flamecraft, which is a game from Lucky Duck, where you have a little dragons, and there's little shops. The art is really cute. And the notion is that basically you're sort of resource managing. You're trying to put these dragons in and buy shops and all this kind of thing. And a really fun game. The one of the pieces of art has a waiter with a dragon on his arm, and the dragon is flaming a creme brulee. So it's that kind of stuff.
Delightful. Sounds like the tea dragons.
Yeah.
Dragons.
Yeah. It was super fun. Scott's company. He just joined them, and this was like their first release after he joined as marketing manager, and he's super happy because it's been a huge hit. We are sold out of it. It's supposed to be coming out before the holidays. We've got some on back order, but it was my favorite game that I played, and it was the first game I played at the convention, which set things off on a good... I'm not going to run down the 40 games that I played. But I will say I played like 30 new games, all new to me. I want to quick mention the stuff that we have that I feel like people should try out.
Uh-huh.
So there's the one I played was called Vengeance Roll and Fight, mm-hmm. which we have had. We kickstarted it. And it is basically a final fight, or like the last third of an action movie. Mm-hmm. You have a character, someone else's character, up to four people. You all have a little like warehouse or something you're going through. You got to fight through minions and fight your way to the boss in four rounds. And you do this by doing rolling dice and pushing your luck and trying to get your sequence that gives you your abilities. I was playing a ninja guy, so I wanted to get a movement, and a hit on my dice. And that would allow me to like do a move, hit combo on things.
Okay.
And you can keep pushing your luck on the dice. If you push it too far, you get wounded. And your other complaint can be with the other players for the dice. So if you don't go quickly enough, they might steal all the dice. And then each turn, once you've got all your maneuvers, you go through this little map and take out the different kind of minions. There's like the boss minions that take two hits. Mm-hmm. There's the gun minions where if you leave them standing, they get to shoot you in the next round. And then there's like the hand-to-hand minions where if you're in the same room with them and you don't take them out, they get to do damage to you. And if you lose all your damage, you get a beatdown, which means you get one less die going forward. And after two beatdowns, you die.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
It is super fun. It's got...
Sounds fun, too. Let me just ask. I don't think it's quite got this level of granularity to it, but... Can you like throw a barrel or anything?
I don't think so. I didn't see anything.
It didn't sound like it was quite like nuanced enough to have like weapon pickups.
No.
But
everybody does have weapons and equipment though that you can choose at the beginning of your game.
Nice.
So like I had.
And so like does that mean like you get like certain colored dice or something like that?
No, they just give you little abilities.
Oh, okay.
That you can get them and then you mark them off. You use them once per turn.
Okay.
So I had shuriken because I was a ninja.
Yep.
I had smoke bombs, which was used the smoke bomb, and once I earned it, I could use it like once, and then it was gone. I got up to four of them in the turn of the game, and the smoke bomb meant that I could use my movement dice as hit dice. So basically, once you throw a smoke bomb down, you're just like a whirlwind of death.
Yeah.
And I had beta blockers, which meant that I could use my maneuvers in whatever order I wanted. Instead of like move, hit, move, I could do hit, hit, move, or whatever.
Okay.
Some neat little abilities. The other guy was playing a biker type guy who, like, when he moved, took a bit of damage because he was old. But a lot of fun. And there's the main game. The season one comes with four characters, and the season two comes with four more, plus more buildings, more equipment, all that kind of stuff. And we have that. It's really fun.
I need to try that at some point.
Yeah, it's a good game.
Say the name.
Vengeance Roll and Fight.
Got it.
There was also a game. I'm just kind of running through my top 10 of stuff we've got. Framework. Which is by Uwe Rosenberg, who's done Agricola and any number of games. This one is a tile-laying game along the lines of like Carcassonne, but it's got different colors of frames, and you're trying to sort of build a connection between like four red frames in a row without breaking it, and that kind of thing. And you've got multiple color frames in each turn, and it seems somewhat simple at first, but when you're trying to build these patterns, it gets complicated fast and very challenging. It was a lot of fun. I think... As we got to it, you get a certain amount of tiles. You run out of tiles, the game ends, and you count it up.
Is this the type of game that if you like Azul or Sagrada?
Yes, I think for sure in that vein.
Okay.
We played it with, I think we had four players, and I won on the second to last turn, right before we ran out of tiles. And then we were uncovering things and counting out to see if I made it, and I had screwed one thing up, so I was 1 point short. So then we went around again, and the guy next to me, right before my turn... He won, and then we counted his out, and he had screwed one thing up, and so I got a chance to win, and I finally did win. But it was, like, within 1 point of everybody else. Very challenging, very fun.
Very dramatic.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that one. I played Marvel Remix, which has some of the same appeal of, like, Marvel Snap that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
It's a card game. It's based on this famous card game, Fantasy Realms, which they've just done a new print of. Basically, it's a drafting kind of game. on your turn, you either draw a card and discard a card, or you can take a card out of the discard pile if you like one of the ones that's available. And in the Marvel version, at least, there's a regular deck and a villain deck. And at the end of the game, you have to have a hero and a villain in your hand, or you lose the game.
Oh, okay.
But then it's like you compare points. So the game ends when there are 10 cards in the discard pile, when nobody, people have just been drawing cards. And you're trying to sort of build, like, I saw, the one I got, I lucked into, I had like 2 Wakanda cards in my hand, and they all had banners like, for every Wakanda card you have, you get plus 7 points.
Oh, okay.
So I started collecting those, I lucked into. So I had like Killmonger as my villain, I had Shuri, I had a, like, a location, I had all this stuff, and as a result, I like doubled all these points, and I got like 100 some points.
Nice.
But there's also like, there's Ant-Man, there's Iron, there's a whole deep cut of like different characters, and you're just trying to sort of make a set.
Is there a D-Man?
I did not see a D-Man, but I didn't look through the entire thing. It's really fun, very quick play. I think we played it in like maybe 15 minutes.
That's cool.
And like I say, some of the same pleasures as Marvel Snap, where you see sort of a lot of characters in there and nice art and that kind of thing.
It's also just a quick game like that is nice to have sort of in between larger things.
Also played the other, my top 10, the other two that we have, a game called Cubitos.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a dice rolling game that is
Been around a little bit, right?
It has been around for about a year and a half, I think.
Yeah.
It is Mario Kart with the dice throwing mechanic.
Okay.
So you're rolling dice, and then you move, and then you get abilities to buy more dice of different colors that give you different abilities, like to. It's kind of like a deck builder, but with dice instead. So you can buy dice that lets you take the weaker dice out of your pool,
mm-hmm.
and then you can buy dice that start doing combat to other players. You can do things that enhance your movement.
It's very deck builder sounding.
There's spaces on the board that are like a shortcut and that kind of thing. It was really fun. And there's like, I think there's like 8 boards in there. There's like a whole bunch of different maps. And the dice are very colorful. They come in little boxes, so it looks cool on the table.
Oh, nice.
So if you like deck builders and dice games, this was a really fun. It's got mechanics I have not seen elsewhere. I thought that was kind of cool.
Okay.
And the last one that's on my top 10 that we have is called Zombicide Gear Up. Zombicide, of course, is the famous like big miniatures battle game of zombies.
Yep. I would not have thought you would necessarily take to the zombies.
Well, I kind of like this. This is a... basically, it's a co-op game. It is called a flip and write. So instead of dice, you have like cards that you're buying from a pool.
Okay. Yeah.
And you have a boss. And so the first round, you are... the 4 of you are like flipping and trying to gear up your 4 weapons. And everybody has different abilities. And you're trying to beat these zombies that spawn. You're kind of like collectively deciding, okay, well, who can take another villain? And then the villains like move up on you. And they've got runners that move faster. They've got zombie dogs.
Yep.
They've got special guys. There was a guy with like a bomber who, if he gets to the bottom of your track, he does damage to everybody.
Uh-huh.
So you kind of have to focus on taking him out, even if the other zombies are biting you.
Right.
And with co-op games, what we often discovered is that like sometimes one guy will sort of take over the game.
Sure.
And you'll be like, okay, well, you're going to do this and this and this, and it's almost not as fun.
Mm-hmm.
Zombicide Gear Up, you're so focused on trying to take care of your thing, you kind of can't do that. Nobody can, like, focus on what's the overall. You got to focus on what you're doing. And the second round, there's a boss zombie. The boss zombie we played in was a super-powered zombie.
Oh.
He moves around the board. So, like, every turn, he's somebody else's problem, but collectively you have to beat him before you run out of turns. While other zombies are still coming at you. It was fun. It gave you that sort of like zombie rush kind of thing you get from like Plants vs. Zombies or
any of those. And it sounds like conceptually, like if not gameplay-wise, it sounded like Left 4 Dead or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. But the flip and right thing was very satisfying. The like being able to gear up. I was able to gear up my like AK-47 so I could shoot stuff next to me so I could help out other players.
Nice.
And I got like a shotgun that let me attack twice if I took a wound. Some fun mechanics in it. And it's a really pretty looking game. Like I thought it was a really good game, and it's considerably cheaper than the other Zombicides.
I was gonna say I actually thought it was a an expansion, but no,
it's a standalone game.
That's cool.
Yeah,
it's good to know too.
Then there's a handful that hopefully we'll be getting. I just want to mention Starship Captains, which is basically very Star Trek-y. It looks very Lower Decks, and you're basically everybody has a starship. You are gearing up your guys. You are promoting your ensigns to commanders and going on away missions. And you have like 4 turns to like repair your damaged ship to get it to up where it's running, and to take on these missions and to earn favor with the space pirate faction, the robot faction, and the other alien faction, while also killing space pirates. really fun. You buy equipment to upgrade your ship, some neat mechanics and sort of a fun sense of humor full of Easter eggs on those. And the other ones that have not come out yet but I'm looking forward to is Eternal Palace, which is a dice game where you're basically trying to impress the Chinese emperor, I think.
Okay.
And so you're rolling dice, you're buying things on this board to, like, there's four monuments, and you pay resources to be the person who is control of this monument, and it's worth points at the end of the game. But every time you, if you go to this space, you can buy the monument from the current player, but it doubles every time.
Oh.
So, like, it might take one wood to buy the big lion, but then it takes two wood for somebody to buy it back, then four, then eight, and we got to the point where it was 60, you had to pay 16 to this resource to get it, which is a lot. And then there's a, you're doing that, you're trying to build the four monuments, you're trying to go to get resources to these places that, like, when you get to the top, you earn a flag, and it was a really fun little resource management game. And then the other one I want to mention is My Shelfie, which is a game where you have bought a new bookshelf. It's got sort of a Connect Four little board, like a 3D board, and you drop in different colored icons from a board that you're buying off of. That's like, there's cats, there's flower vases, there's books, and you're trying to pattern match like certain colors and that kind of thing. And by the end, you have this very pretty, like, 5x5 board of, like, a bookshelf.
What was that game?
My Shelfie.
Shelfie.
Yeah. it was really fun.
Sean Connery talking about taking a selfie.
It does, yes, it's My Shelfie. just to hit a couple of, without going too much into things that we have that I really liked and played, Our Travels, which is the knitting game. There's a Mists Over Carcassonne coming, which is a co-op Carcassonne with a spooky vibe. Unicorn Stew, a fast play game where you're trying to feed the king various awful... It's full of dark humor about serving up fantasy creatures for food. We have that one in our party games. I think that's about it. Like I say, I played a lot of games, but that's the stuff that sort of hit me the most.
And did you win your game? Did you play more games than you did the previous one?
I did. I played 39 games. I did not quite get to 40, but 35 was my goal, and I made that goal.
Nice.
So I did beat my mini game. Nick, you press play this weekend.
I press played a lot this weekend.
I know there was a couple you wanted to talk about. You want to talk about Duel?
Yeah, Duel's this weird... I had heard it mentioned on a podcast like a couple months ago and completely forgot about it and was surfing Hulu last night and came across it. And I was like, oh, right. This is a movie that has Karen Gillan and Aaron Paul from Breaking Bad. Yeah. And it's kind of this weird concept where it's a world where if you have, like, a disease and you are going to die, to sort of spare your loved ones the heartache of loss, you can clone yourself.
So this was this year, right?
Came out yes.
Okay. And it's written and directed by the guy who's married to Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
Yeah.
Or was, 5 years ago.
Yes. He also is the director of that movie, which I never saw, The Art of Self-Defense.
Yeah, I don't really see it either.
His name's Riley Stearns. This movie was very interesting. It went in directions I wasn't quite expecting. Because it all sort of focuses on Karen Gillan and sort of her relationship with her mother and her boyfriend. And kind of like the at-odds nature of some of that is, but she still loves them. Every character also talks in this kind of very kind of interesting cadence of speech where it's they seem a little inhuman, like they're just odd. It's very fast paced and almost robotic.
Is it meant to like have like this staccato style of like an old 50s film, like where newspaper reporters talk fast to each other?
It felt a little like that, but
Or is it supposed to literally be some futurism thing where people are talking in, like, Blade Runner talk?
I feel like that's the cadence of speech everyone was talking in. And But the big deal is this. If she kind of miraculously heals, and they have a law in effect that a person cannot have a clone... and if the clone desires to stay alive, they must now have a duel to the death.
Sure, well, that's just law.
Yeah, you know. And it's sort of about her, Karen Gillan, sort of psyching herself up and training to kill her clone.
That's weird and messed up.
It's weird and messed up. Karen Gillan.
What is the vibe of this movie?
Very indie.
Dark comedy?
Okay, all right.
Indie dark comedy.
Okay, all right.
And Karen Gillan does a really quiet, really great job.
Native accent?
She does an American accent.
She seems to almost always do American accents.
She does. She does it really well, too. Yeah. But her back and forth with herself is very interesting. Aaron Paul plays the person who is training her. And he is kind of odd, and
I think Aaron Paul might be kind of odd because his character in Westworld was a little weirdo too.
Was he?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that tracks.
Yeah, it does.
But I like him. So this was kind of one of those unexpected treats that I wasn't expecting much from, but came out really enjoying it.
Okay, all right. The other one, this is the one that I think we all want to see, is The Menu.
Yes, The Menu.
It's another one, by the way, I was looking at the director. It's Mark Mylod.
I don't recognize that name.
So he did a lot. He was co-producer on Entourage.
Oh, weird.
And he directed Ali G in the House.
Okay.
Like, I'm looking at the movies he's done. He's done 8 movies, and I'm like, none of these would make me think, wow, this guy is definitely going to make a cool, dark horror social movie, but it seems like he may have.
And I don't want to say too much about this, because I feel like this is one of those movies, the less you know, the better. But just know that it's about a restaurant on an island that is sort of like the creme de la creme, only the richest can afford. And Ralph Fiennes plays the head chef, who is a little crazy.
I'm assuming it involves cannibalism at some point, but I'm not. You don't
need no. I'm not going to tell you. And the cast list is amazing. Anya Taylor-Joy does a great job.
Who seems to be in 50% of all movies?
She is. And Nicholas Holt. Is in the other 50%.
The two character actors I really want to kind of shine. Well, there's actually three. Hong Chau, who you will know from the miniseries of Watchmen.
Yeah.
She was
right.
She plays kind of the maitre d'. And she's amazing. John Leguizamo does...
He's almost always good.
He's always good. Is. And I read an interview with him after the fact saying that he was a kind of channeling a character of... oh, crap. The asshole that we listened to a podcast about.
Steven Seagal.
Steven Seagal. He was channeling Steven Seagal because he...
He worked with him on Executive Decision.
He said he worked with him on Executive Decision, and he was an asshole.
Yeah.
So he was like...
Yeah, he lived up to his...
And then a character actor named Paul Adelstein.
Okay.
He plays a kind of a ass-kisser to a reviewer who is kind of in love with the chef. Okay. And... Actually, everyone in this movie is good. It is a biting satire of food culture and the way we kind of put them on pedestals.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I heard Serena, I think, saw it with her partner and really liked it and described it as being sort of a satirical of, like, sort of bougie foodies and
it's other funny, stuff. It's dark, but... I loved it. So, but I'm also, I like food stuff in general. It was definitely made, not for me, but I'm definitely a fan of that.
Okay. So. Yeah, kind of an energetic movie?
Yes.
A slow moving movie?
No, it's methodically paced, but it moves at a good pace.
The trailer looked like it could be like that,
I'm excited to watch this one. I'll probably not see it till...
If the opportunity presented itself, I'd like to see it in the theaters. I just think I'm going to be a little busy to quite make it happen.
Yeah. Well, I've been watching a little show called Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I don't know if you guys have heard of it. So a pretty...
I don't know. What's this one
pretty
about?
Pretty obscure. It's about Deep Space Nine.
This is the one with Scott Bakula, right?
Yes. So I...
Didn't we determine recently that it's about 30 years
it
old?
It is close to 30 years old. But it started... about what season 5 of Deep Space of Next Gen? Where Best of Both Worlds? It came out right after the Borg stuff did. I feel like it started.
That was season 2.
Was that season? No.
Yeah.
So Steve,
that was the end of season 2.
Yeah. The Borg had a long history before they.
So I think
a few like and so like 3 years might have passed. But it always loomed large in fan remembrances. So Randy, it bridged season 2 and 3. It was the finale of season 2 and the start of season 3.
Okay, but Deep Space Nine came out during, like, season 4, I think.
It came out in 93.
Yeah, I'm trying to think when Next Gen
does. But anyway, the reason you may mention this is it's relevant because the Borg play a key role in the life of Sisko.
Yes, so
the captain of this border station.
For those who don't know, the basis of this is it is a DSpace 9 was a mining station owned by the Cardassians, these bad guy aliens.
Right, they had occupied the planet.
They'd occupied the planet Bajor. The Bajorans had overthrown them. Mm-hmm. And now the Federation was coming in to basically help the Bajorans, basically run the space station for the Bajorans and keep the Cardassians at bay.
Right. The Bajorans throughout the whole series are in sort of a reconstruction era, and there's a lot of like infighting and power mongering and you know like power plays and stuff.
Yep.
So that just getting restabilizing after war like is a very complicated process. It's a weirdly set notion for a Star Wars thing.
Yeah, it's very grim. And also, because Star Trek is a post-scarcity society, but Bajor and this edge of the quadrant isn't. And so they have, like, this is where Gold Press Latinum, and, like, there's gambling on board the station. There are people come here to do deals. Like, it was very non-Star Trek in some ways.
They also said the quiet part out loud, that the holodeck, or smaller holosuites, which they have there, pretty explicitly used for sex as well as adventure-y stuff.
Yep.
Because like they have some of their traditional holodeck adventures, but what Quark is selling his bar
is not
that ain't traditional.
So the cast is great. They brought in Miles O'Brien from the Enterprise to be their chief engineer.
From TNG,
And Sisko is played by... He was probably their
favorite... Brooks.
Avery Brooks. He was their famous actor at this point.
Yeah, he was, Hawk
on Spencer for Hire.
Yeah. But also, I think, kind of came from a bit of that same Shakespearean, theater background like Patrick Stewart had.
Yeah.
So he can give big speeches.
There's Major Kira, who is, she was a Bajoran freedom fighter, and now she is, the second-in-command of the station, but she...
Making the second-in-command a person who, in other incarnations of Star Trek, would potentially be called a terrorist...
Yeah.
...was a pretty big thing.
Well, and she bristles at the Federation, but also she knows they need them, and now she's kind of caught between, her old allies who are you sold out to the man...
Right.
And then her
and
Federation people...
I'm trying to stick it to the man every chance I can get.
And her Federation people who are you're such a troublemaker, why don't you just settle down and help us?
Yeah.
So she's a really interesting character. Nana Visitor plays her. She's great.
Yep.
Odo is the chief of security. He's a shapeshifter. We'll find a lot more about him later. See, here's the thing. I have seen, three or four seasons of this, but, in scattershot 30 years ago.
Right.
So I don't remember
Brandon,
most
were you
of it.
I skipped it at the time because I was a Babylon 5 guy.
That was part of it.
And I was I don't need to see this knockoff, which I now see is, they're actually rather different.
They're very
how
different.
They play
you can
play
see
out.
They may have... There's very strong rumors that Babylon 5, the pitch document for that was at Paramount, and basically it made its way to Berman and Miller, or Berman and Pillar, and that they had something to do with it. You can look at it, especially if you squint, you're like... Yeah, I can see where Babylon 5 was the origination of this, but it's such a different thing. It's like if there were two Asteroid movies and they were very different.
I mean, I think it's more different than that.
You're right, it is. But it's a space station. There's some
and they're both
space.
They're both gritty, right?
They're both gritty.
Yeah.
So you can see where there might be some original, but in no way is this a ripoff of Babylon 5 or vice versa.
Yeah.
It's just they have both be about space stations.
They're both
and
two great tastes and should be enjoyed separately.
Separately, not together. That'd be weird. You watch an episode of Deep Space Nine, an episode of Babylon 5, you won't be able to find a narrative. It's very weird. but all the characters are really good. Later on, Worf will join them.
You're a third of the way into season one?
I'm 10 or 11 episodes in. And
okay,
so
maybe
far,
roughly at the halfway point.
There has been one episode I disliked.
Yep.
And everything else I've really liked.
Yep. And the episode you disliked is one that is people are famous for disliking.
It's so Star Trek goofy. I hated it so much.
here's something I wanted to bring up. Although this show is increasingly, as time goes on, but even by the second season, it's starting to get into more serial storytelling, long-form arcs, or having a story that will just be reflected in some, just a few episodes down the line.
Yeah.
There are still a lot of those Star Trek kind of one-off stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I find found that first season, although some people, they do with everything, they're you can skip the first season and just jump to season two or three. And there's a lot of good stuff in season one.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's fun to see some of those, like, because occasionally they go off and they'll explore some planet or something, or an alien fugitive will come into the station and they'll have to deal with the, you know, Randy, you just talked about the episode. There's one where essentially there's an alien, like, race that's, like, been bred to be hunted, like, yeah, foxes,
mm-hmm,
and they're chased onto the station, and the station basically has to decide how involved do they want to get,
yeah,
in this,
yeah,
very clearly immoral thing. But it does seem like that the prey in it does live to be prey.
Yeah.
Like, that's...
Well, it's interesting because they're dealing with the Prime Directive in a different way. Like, they're not going to the other civilizations. The civilizations are coming to them. And it's much more of a moral dilemma. Like, what do we interfere? It came to us. Like, it...
Right.
And there's a lot of that kind of stuff here. I think flipping it so that they're a station instead of a ship really does change it in interesting, mm-hmm, ways.
Right, he is trying to, Sisko is trying to provide stability in this region.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of people will point to the episode where Q shows up. I know you haven't hit it yet.
No, I have.
Oh, you have? Okay.
Q and, what's her name?
It's Vosh, right?
Vosh.
Yeah.
Vosh and Q are like a couple now.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And she's like breaking up with him.
Because she had gone off traveling, yeah, with him. That was Picard's
ex. Basically, breaking up with a narcissistic supreme being is not easy.
Right. But famously, Sisko punches Q,
yeah,
when he shows up, and, yes, and Q is like, "Picard never did that."
Yeah,
and that's one of those defining, "This is how this show is different,"
yeah,
moments.
Yeah,
because also, like, when he gets there, he kind of blackmails people. A lot of people are leaving the station, yeah, and it could lose basically become a nothing and, yep, lose its ability to keep the region stable.
Yep.
And so he has to, like, blackmail people, like Quark,
Quark to stay.
And that's episode one.
Yeah.
Like, or,
yeah,
or the second part of episode one, yeah, maybe, but
Sisko is very much more of a dealer kind of captain. He's not a negotiator in the same way that Picard is, but he's very much a sharp guy who knows how to wield the diplomatic power,
yep,
he's got.
Yep, and this was, I forget what the involvement is, if any, early on by, who's the Battlestar Galactica guy? Ron Moore.
Ron Moore comes on later, I believe.
He's, yeah, not, and in Ron the Moore, season, man, he is on fire in this.
Yeah.
You know, I think overall it is decidedly better than, you know, unless it wraps poorly, which nobody has ever told me it did.
Yeah.
Better than Galactica, easily.
Yeah.
Doesn't, you know, Galactica is a different beast and doesn't necessarily need to be compared. But it felt like he had a better game plan in this. Yeah. They just did.
Because I know what's coming. I know about the Defiant. I know about the Dominion War. I know Worf's, yeah, going to join them.
You know, some
looking
loose,
forward to all,
you know,
of that stuff joining in. But even just watching the early season, I'm like, you know, this is a solid Star Trek.
Yeah.
This is,
if you're liking it pretty well now, that bodes well for the future.
This is stronger than Next Gen was at this point.
Oh, season, God.
Yeah.
Next Gen was not like this strong until season 3.
And even then, I don't know that I mean, Deep Space Nine does things differently than Next Gen. And
the writing,
like,
is superior.
Yeah, it's just maybe a better version.
Even their casual one-off episodes and stuff like that just have broadly better writing.
Yeah.
And they want to challenge Trek a little bit more. It is more deliberately subversive.
Until you bring in a dumb alien who plays games.
Yes, and they make them sing and stuff.
They make,
yeah,
them sing. I felt bad for the actors.
Yep, my buddy father, he definitely likes that episode.
No.
I'm not sure if how much he likes it because he legitimately likes it. I think he does, but I believe he also likes it a little bit to troll people.
Yeah, well, that'll work, because I hated it. Dave, you went back a little further than me, I think, and you watched Fantastic Voyage.
I went to the 1960s.
He travels to the 1960s.
Yeah. Random watch. This was one of those. Started watching it while I was eating. Just turned on something. I'd been wanting to revisit it again for a while and see if it held up at all well. This is the movie where people shrink down inside a, like, sort of submarine type craft and go inside a human body.
For this mysterious disease?
Yeah. I'll get to it in just a second.
Okay.
But it's people may be a little bit more familiar if you're like an 80s kid with Inner Space. The movie the most clearly was inspired by it. That was Joe Dante's.
I was going to say sidebar. That's Joe Dante of Gremlins fame. I,
yep,
forgot that until
and
recently.
I believe it's Joe Dante's best movie. It's funny. It's weird.
Agreed.
It's big special effect movie. Great.
Agreed.
Great effect.
Has the cowboy.
It has the cowboy in it. Who played him?
Oh man, it's the guy who played Joe Souza. Is it Joe Leisure or something? I think it's.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't remember who it is.
But Inner Space is like the more serious version of that. And it is really good. Like, it kind of reminded me in a way of like adventure, old school adventure movies, like the kind of Disney movies like Treasure Island,
yeah,
or 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, where, mm-hmm, you're like, this is just really well crafted.
Yeah.
Now, and then in a minute, I'm going to get to the extreme sexism of it.
Uh-oh. Dave, do you think when was this conterminous with the Fantastic Four? Was this before or after? Like,
I don't know.
I'm just curious. Do you think... I mean, because I always get the vibe maybe there was something similar in
I don't
the...
think so, actually.
Okay,
all
right.
The characters don't have the family dynamics.
Okay, I thought they did.
Yeah, there's... it's a military guy who's brought in who knows nothing about this project, and okay. That's why, as he is briefed on it, we, the audience, are briefed on it.
Okay, all right.
He's like a Navy frogman and stuff like that, and he's like, what do you want? What is even going on here?
If they did a remake, he'd be a Navy SEAL?
He'd be a Navy SEAL.
But in the 50s is a frogman.
But it begins with this kind of... there's almost like... it's not Michael Crichton serious, but with its technology, but it's more serious than you'd think, maybe. Miniaturization can only last for an hour.
Okay.
That's the limitation of it. And he will find this out later. And so the movie roughly takes place in real time from the time they get miniaturized, so there's a little bit of time to fill before that, 30, 40 minutes. And when it begins, there's a guy who's, like, on an airplane being rushed off by, like, armed guards and stuff like that. You're like, oh, what's going on? It's nighttime. They're driving him through the city. There's, like, army dudes with him. Oh, people are shooting at him from rooftops. He gets, like, shot or something like that. And taken to this, like, secret compound, which is, like, the pit from mm-hmm. G.I. Joe. It had secret elevators that take you down.
Nice.
Maybe the first time that had been done, I'm sure that was the source of, like, that idea.
Yeah.
And then they bring in this guy arrives there, and he basically finds out there's this big secret underground complex. It's where they work on miniaturization technology. Both sides, which, though they never get into it, but of course the Americans and the Russians, I'm sure, are working on this technology. Everybody wants to get the next step, but you can just do it for an hour. Well, Randy, the guy they're operating on is uh-huh. the guy who has the secret of going longer than an hour.
Oh.
So they need this guy to live, and that's why they were trying to kill him.
Okay,
so there's a neat kind of thriller aspect to get your blood pumping and being like, what's going on? What's going on? And then he finds out, he's incredulous at first, but he finds out that, yes, this guy has an injury that can only be resolved with the technology of the actual miniaturization technology. Other experiments would kill him. And so he the guy reluctantly agrees, and there's a pilot, there's Donald Pleasance,
Looking to see, so Donald Pleasance is in there, I saw Raquel Welch.
Yep. She's the doctor's assistant, and even from the beginning, there is some concern about a possible saboteur.
The lead is Stephen Boyd, who was also in Ben-Hur. I'm looking at something else that he was in.
Oh, James Doohan.
Cleopatra.
Man, if he was invisible to me.
I also noticed, Dave, this is interesting, the director of this is Richard Fleischer.
Okay.
Who also did Soylent Green.
Okay, that's one of my favorite movies. Oh, wow.
Conan the Destroyer.
Not a great movie, but fun.
he directed 52 films, but like I'm
this
looking
guy
like,
clearly, it sounds like he had a clear love of adventure.
Yeah, Fantastic Voyage, 20,000 Leagues, and Soylent Green to some extent, all similar.
Yeah.
He directed maybe the original Dr. Doolittle, which I know is also kind of an adventure movie.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the other stuff here that's on his list. Tora, 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 which I believe was one of those...
That was like a World War II thing.
Pearl Harbor
movie,
this
was that the one that like was seen from the perspective of the Japanese or divided equal time between
them? I think it might have been.
Yeah.
But he did The Jazz Singer. Okay. Neil Diamond's Jazz Singer. So he's got a pretty decent...
that is a pretty good resume.
Yeah.
And I would say this is in a lot of ways it is an ideal old school action adventure movie. Again,
okay.
Definitely not action, but adventure. So once they go in, and like I said, there's some question about a possible saboteur.
Yep.
And so that creates some tension later on. The thing with the sexism, Raquel Welch is like a medical assistant, but like the whole thing is like everybody is immediately like, oh, you're too beautiful to be working in a place
this.
And they're all almost everything they're talking about her is how beautiful she is. It's like... maybe she'll go out on a date with one of us kind of jokes and stuff. Yeah, it's pretty bad. So just brace yourself for that. Once she gets going, they do show her to be competent and good, but there's a little bit of that, like, kind of the way Sue was in the Fantastic Four early on. That's the only sort of major dynamic. The main guy is kind of, he's a bit of a square-jawed man of action.
Sure.
He's smart and, not real, like... hokey action guy, but he's a man of action kind of dude.
So I think this is what I was thinking, is like it was sort of more of a Reed Richards, Sue Storm in that way.
Yeah, no, she doesn't have anybody she's connected with romantically, yeah. So there's not quite that dynamic, and there's no family.
I just was thinking them as that, so that Reed Richards is almost that square-jawed type guy. He's a science engineer, but
and well, back when he was a military guy too.
It's true.
So anyway, they get shrunk down, and that is actually like they show this like 10-minute process of how they exactly ultimately get them into a syringe. They do. I told Nick about this the other day.
Yeah, it was
a rather
cool
elaborate
sequence.
Thing where they need to show how they get them in without being like, you know, when you're that small, any jostle could damage you or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's like first they shrink them down on this pedestal.
Yep.
And then the pedestal like rises up, and then a like robotic thing is wheeled in and slowly like puts them like essentially inside. They're actually still visible at that point. It's small but just visible. They're like put inside a thing that goes then inside a that they go inside a liquid, and that liquid is like dropped inside a syringe.
Yeah.
The syringe is then shrunk, and that's when they get really small.
Yeah.
And then the machine does the, you know, inserts the injects them into the thing so that it's all handled with like extreme caution. And that part, like, you know how I was telling Nick, in Iron Man, you know how that first movie they wanted you to make sure you understood the technology could work?
Yeah.
It felt like it could work when you watch this.
Have you ever, do you remember Disney, Disneyland had a 20,000 Leagues, and they also had a...
I went to Body Wars.
Yeah, Fantastic Voyage, yeah.
Yeah, and it was super cool. Yeah. They had that, like, you would go through, like, this thing that was, like, glowing, that's like, you're going through this sterilization chamber.
I remember they were,
or, like,
they were basically showing you how you got injected into things, yeah.
And it was, it's 100% inspired
that's
by
cool.
this. Once they get in, the special effects are great. It's practical effects, and yet you have a very clear sense of where they are in the body because they keep cutting between them and like the sort of the brass who are like showing on, like looking on a monitor and like on some art because they don't have like computer models or anything. So they're looking at like a little sort of thing that tracks them, and they can see where they're going. They're like, oh, well, we thought we were going to be able to take this passage, but it turns out because of some nature of his injury, we're going to have to go the long way around. Oh, no, we're going to have to pass through the heart. Oh, no, there's always one thing after another.
Yeah.
And they're like, we'll be destroyed in the heart. It's just the current is too strong. It'll destroy the ship. And they're like, oh, we can slow his heart to 4 beats a minute by putting him in, like, cryostasis.
So are they communicating with the team,
They're
basically?
Communicating with
okay,
them, yeah.
Okay, interesting.
And they're like, we can slow his heartbeat, but we can only do it safely for, like, a couple minutes. And so you have to get through it in that time. And they're really small, of course. And so, and these, you know, there's times when... the body's natural defenses are reacting against them. There's a time when they have to go through the ear and to get through something, and they're like, if there's even a single sound in that operating room, it's going to vibrate the ear and destroy us.
Oh, wow.
And so all the scientists are frozen in the room, not doing anything, or all the medical technicians.
Yeah.
There's like sweats pouring down them and stuff like that. And eventually somebody does accidentally like knock some scissors onto the floor, mm-hmm. just in their panic.
Yeah.
Again, one thing after another, eventually there is stuff with the saboteur. They have to do dives. They have to go out there and, like, at one point they're leaking oxygen and they have to literally, like, oxygenate by plugging into, like, the lungs and drawing air from that.
Hmm.
But at every stage, like, they sort of explained what they're doing, and it's super cool. People who like Raquel Welch, which I would consider myself among them, will be happy to know that she does go out in like a white Black Widow like wetsuit,
yeah,
like
sure.
all of them.
Yeah,
but she looks better than all of them.
Yes, of course. You know, it's interesting, Dave. In all the indie RPGs we've had and that kind of thing in board games, no one's ever done like a adventure board game like this, like science adventure board game,
like
this. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
You know, I bet there has been. There was a video game I remember on my brother's TI-99 called Microsurgeon.
Okay.
That was like a little sort of pew-pew game, but like kind of had a little bit of seriousness where you had to go and eliminate like anything from like tar in the lungs to clear out because he was a smoker,
yep.
to viruses that would get in and stuff like that. And there must be some board game equivalent, but there's only these two movies, Interspace and Fantastic Voyage,
yeah.
as far as I can recall.
But it's been riffed on, so, like, I'm sure The Simpsons has done it.
There's
all kinds of, like, references to the Fantastic Voyage. Like, it's one of those things that, like, captures the imagination, I think.
And the visuals are consistently very vivid and stunning. You'll look at some of that stuff and you'll be like, how did they do that without computer animation? At times you're going to be able to see like, oh yeah, that area they're going through, where the alveoli are scraping up against their ship, and you're like, okay, that is clearly practical effects and these like plant-like things that somebody's probably dangling over their ship. But But a lot of it is pretty stunning to this day.
I feel like they did an Avengers issue like this. They shrunk down one
inside the Vision. Yeah. Neil Adams drew it as few people, but Neil Adams can, and Ant-Man went inside him.
Yeah, that's
Ant-Man's
right.
Ant-Man's done this a few times.
Yeah, that's going to say Ant-Man
he
was
maybe the direct inheritor of this
movie. I
wonder
if Ant-Man was inside. This was 1966.
Okay.
And Ant-Man, I don't know when he came out. Maybe right before, right after?
But that might have been where they were starting to think about that shrinking tech.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So...
Anyway, I definitely highly recommend it. Brace yourself for extreme sexism, though.
All right. We're going to give a spoiler warning. If you've not seen Wakanda Forever, I'm surprised. And a little disappointed in you. But
we're not mad, just disappointed.
You should skip this last part of the podcast, because we are going to talk about and probably spoil a bunch of stuff from Black Panther 2, Wakanda Forever. And that is your spoiler warning, and now we're going to talk about it.
Come with us, take a walk on the wild side.
No.
I said it. I did it.
I left this movie happy with it, but thinking not as good as the first one, and maybe there was a couple, just it wasn't quite where I wanted it to be. Like I really want to have another first Black Panther or, you know, the Cat Winter Soldier, that reaction to a Marvel movie of like, oh my god, that was amazing.
Yeah.
And I haven't had that reaction to him in a while. This is as close as I've gotten in the theater. But the more I think about it, the more I like it, and I kind of want to see it again.
I think this is, I mean, walking out of it, I thought this was the best it could be.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, honestly...
Well, we all know that they had an impossible mission. It's
well,
extreme.
The story swerved that they had written out and everything.
Yeah, they were working on Black Panther 2, and then Chadwick Boseman died of cancer. And also, then Shuri started posting anti-vax nonsense.
Yes.
So they had a whole bunch of stuff to deal with, and I'm glad they didn't replace her. I have seen people's complaints that basically, what is her name?
Letitia Wright.
Letitia Wright, that maybe she was not quite up to carrying the movie. And I think that's fair. I think that this was a very different role than what she was signed on for.
She did good work.
She's good.
And she, like, went through a lot of, like, pretty intense emotion in this movie, which is not easy for any actor.
Her story arc is valid and there.
It's really good, but...
But I do agree. There's a little bit of a sense that she wasn't the person to carry the movie.
Seeing her play this sort of angry, burn the world down person... is so different than the joyful Shuri of the first movie.
Yeah.
You can understand how she gets there, but it's a shame that she had to get there. Like, I wanted Shuri to be the fun character. There was all this stuff with, like, Tumblr stuff about what's going to happen when Shuri meets Spider-Man, and they're both these weird science nerds. And now they're completely different characters, even though Spidey's been through his things, too. But
right. She was, like, ball-busting her brother in that first one, and, like, that was one of the things.
And now she is just, like, focused on vengeance because she's lost the person she cared about most in the world.
Right, but she also, I mean, her character arc is that she hasn't come to terms with that.
She hasn't dealt with it, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's before we get sort of into more specific, let's just quick talk about the opening, which was a very emotional opening, I think, for just about everybody.
Yeah.
Do they open with the funeral?
Yeah. They open with her. She's in the lab trying to create the heart-shaped herb.
Right.
To save Black Panther, because it's Black Panther.
Right.
She's trying to save his life.
It's a weird feeling of, like, reality and movie merging.
I thought that, I was wondering, this is one of the biggest questions I had, and I'm glad they answered it very quickly, is are they going to have a thing where he died of some, you know, doing something heroic, or is it a thing of like a disease killed him? Because they never say it, but it's very clearly implied of like he was secretly fighting this disease and never told anybody, and so they couldn't help him.
Well, yeah, she wasn't trying to do the heart-shaped herb for him because he already had that at that point. She was trying to survive or come up with the solution of what was killing him.
She's trying to cure the whatever it was, which they never say is cancer, but I feel like it's basically cancer.
Yeah.
The thing that made me like kind of break down is when they showed the Marvel logo.
Oh man! Yeah, instead of Chadwick Boseman,
the usual array of heroes, it was all images of him. Oh,
they
my
did
God.
That with Stan Lee.
Yeah,
Captain Marvel.
Yeah, Captain Marvel. They did that with Stan Lee. The same thing. I was like, man, the thing that there's been a big controversy about this, and I know some people very, very have strong opinions about it, whether or not they should have recast T'Challa.
You know what's interesting is as I've been talking about it with people lately. More and more people, at least that I've talked to randomly, have said they shouldn't have and they made the right decision.
And I think they did. And I think the reason they did is because this let us all mourn Chadwick Boseman together. Like, this wasn't just them mourning Black Panther. It was all the audience mourning what we lost in Chadwick Boseman.
They changed the direction of what they story was going to be.
Yeah.
I mean, the opening scene is kind of the sadness, and then the funeral itself is like, I don't want to say joy, but it was sort of a celebration of life.
Yeah.
And that was kind of what you
the
wanted.
The first of many scenes that you know, show the cool kind of like Afrofuturism of the concepts here. And that, like, oh, right, we, you know, there is kind of an assumption of, like, you know, we've seen so many movies, the, you know, somber funeral where everybody is, like, in, you know, like, black coats and stuff like that. And
well, it's, like, the direct opposite of what we got for Iron Man, which was kind of this somber, very sad kind of
and
funeral.
And Iron Man was still well done, but, like, yeah, like, this, we're seeing another country.
But also the point has been made in Black Panther, and it's reinforced very heavily here, that in their culture, death is not the end. That they know the ancestors are watching after them.
Except for Shuri doesn't believe.
Except for Shuri doesn't believe. I thought
she's a full-on scientist person, and she thinks her mom and other people are a little bit deluded.
I thought that was a bold thing to do in a Marvel movie where basically they don't come out and say she's an atheist, but she basically is an atheist.
Yeah.
She's like, this is all spiritual nonsense. My brother's gone.
Yeah. Right.
And I thought that was interesting to do, and then to confront her with, no, it's actually, this is not just like a thing they believe. This is real.
Yeah.
And for her to, like, even after having experienced the spirit realm, to come back and be like, I didn't see anything.
By the way, this is a persistent theme in Deep Space Nine.
Interesting. Okay.
But don't you think
because
she
of the
didn't,
nature of Sisko.
Yeah.
Don't you think she said that she didn't see anything because of the guilt of who she saw?
I think that's part of it, but I also think she didn't want to admit that it was real.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I see that was
but
part
of it.
But
by the way, what a great reveal, because I did not see that coming. There's one of those things that could have been spoiled, but the fact that Killmonger is in it and is in the spirit realm means they can still use Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah.
Yeah, that guy is a great villain.
Yeah.
A real energetic and charismatic guy.
And it made perfect sense for her to see him at that point.
Yeah.
Because, well, vengeance had consumed her.
One of the other things I think is interesting about this movie is, as with the first Black Panther, their villains and their antagonists and their arcs are all about sort of a little bit of gray, because I felt for most of this, like, Shuri was right. She should have been wanting to burn down the world, and that Namor certainly is right. Like, that the world, that they've been proven, that they've proven the very opening action sequence that all the other governments are going to come for their vibranium. Like, they are right to be paranoid about it.
Let's quick talk about that scene, because that gets the movie its first action energy.
Yeah.
So, what is her name who takes over as like
Ramonda.
Regent, I guess? Is she regent?
Angela Bassett is queen.
Yeah. Oh, she's queen, right. And Angela, actually, that is in life, too, by the way. Angela Bassett is queen in life.
Yes, she is. She's amazing in this.
But she like, addresses, what, the United Nations?
Yep.
And it's like,
well, and everyone's after her. They're basically hounding her for, like, you can't keep that to yourself. It's like a... It's like having all the nukes or something like
that.
Along those lines.
She reveals that she is fully aware of everybody's fascination with and desire to take from them, and that in fact that in the time that prior to this, that somebody tried to militarily take it in.
There's a great line in there where she talks about, she's basically like, we were never afraid of the potential of vibranium. We're afraid of you.
Yeah.
You're not ready for this.
Yep.
And that moment where it's like, it's the French, but I feel like it's almost an international operation. It's like mercenaries, right?
Maybe,
no,
but it was definitely
it's
set
straight,
by the
it's straight
French.
Up the French.
Yeah. It was the French government in this case.
Because it was the French UN addressing her.
You
like
see
saying,
them initially looking like they are coming in all Black Ops style, and they take over like the installation.
Science facility, and then
they open the doors to what they think is like the vibranium chamber.
And the Dora Milaje walk out.
Yep. Yeah.
And that was such a great
audience,
like,
by the way,
like, oh,
freaked
yeah.
when,
well,
when that happened.
You're like, oh, you guys are so fucked.
And the music cues are so good.
Yeah, they are. And they give... Wakanda has one style, and Talokan
has
a different
another.
One.
And the Dora Milaje have their own.
The Dora Milaje have their own,
yeah. So that was very cool and sets things up. And yes, we will later, let's talk about Namor for a second.
Yeah, so Namor is introduced. There's a military installation, a U.S. military installation.
Because they figure
they're
out how
trying
to find.
They're trying to find vibranium. They have a tracker to find vibranium.
They have a machine that was built.
Yep.
And so
they're drilling, and it turns out, vibranium exists in Talokan as well, which, by the way, what a great way to tie Talokan and Wakanda together.
Yeah.
The fact that vibranium exists, so that's why they have this civilization of, like, underwater technology. That's why they can do all these things.
They have their own Harshaderberg.
They have their own Harshaderberg.
And this is, of course, this is a rethink of the Atlantean yep. Namor. Pretty much everybody I've talked to agrees that they captured Namor's imperiousness.
Yep.
He does feel a little, like, younger in this. Yeah. Like, not quite the Namor who's, like...
Which is funny, because he's older than Namor in the comics.
Yeah, he was born in, like, 1571?
1500s, yeah, something like that, yeah.
Right, but just physically, but yes, the actor just looks younger, a little younger than he does in the comics. Correct. You know, he might be, like, a permanent 30 or 35 or something like that. And has a little bit of that feeling of, like, I've been king before.
Yeah.
And this guy feels a little bit new, even though, yes, he has been around. But he captures the imperiousness. And also, but a nuanced kind of, like, he's you can care about this person.
Yeah. They did a good
job. And he is, what we will find out is, that, like, they're an offshoot of the Mayan culture.
They capture his arrogance, but not in the same, it's not a, you know, a Quicksilver and Namor are very similar in the comics. They're both arrogant kind of jerks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's not a jerk. He just basically has no time for anyone else's opinions.
Right.
He's like, no, I know what I'm talking about. And he's almost gentle when he first talks to Shuri and Ramonda. Mm-hmm. He comes out of the water and he's like, look, he didn't bring his army, or he doesn't show them his army. He had his army with him.
Yeah.
But he basically is just like, look, you gotta find me the scientist that did this and bring it to me, because that science is a danger to both of us. And he is trying to work a sort of diplomatic thing where he wants to basically have Wakanda and Atlantis be a power against all the imperialist powers that exist, which honestly, again, is a good idea.
Yeah. That said, it's always a little dodgy when you're like, I need to assassinate someone.
Yeah.
Hand him over.
Yeah.
Well, and by the way, like, you can get rid of the scientist who can find vibranium today, and there will be another one in a few years.
Well, and also, he wants to, like, destroy the world.
So. Especially when we find out who the scientist is.
Yep.
And it's Riri Williams, which, what a fantastic version of her, too.
Like, yeah, it's really good.
She was using Stark tech that she found on the internet. That's why she built her suit. But they got her away from being, like, Stark's protege, which I think was a very smart move.
Yeah.
So she's her own woman.
Yeah.
And I thought she was going to be coming from, like, Shuri's project in L.A.
Right.
But no, they just meet here, and I thought it was really well done. I love that when she first sees Shuri, she knows exactly who she is.
Yep.
She's you're Princess Shuri. She's a little starstruck by her, and I thought that was really cool. And I thought their Riri Williams was really, really good.
I do, too. A complaint with the movie is that there's a lot going on.
There's a lot going on.
And the Riri Williams, while good, it felt a little separated.
Like a sub-quest.
I agree. And the thing is, we know she's getting a show, so this is basically just to set her up.
Yeah. And I knew that, so I was okay with that.
Yeah.
But this movie is beefy in time-wise.
There's a lot going on.
And events and stuff.
And if we didn't straight up say it, it's a long movie.
It is a long movie.
2 hours, 40 minutes, so. Yeah.
But they do a great job. The Martin Freeman stuff is fun.
That's the Martin Freeman and Val.
And Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
So the reveal that they were married is fun. But again, it's one of those things that, like, I'm not sure it belongs in such a long movie. It feels almost like it doesn't belong with the rest of the story.
Yeah. Right. But it's like the connective tissue that it has to be there in order
for
for the MCU.
Yeah.
And I get that.
I do too. I'm fine with it.
I'm fine with it. I don't know if everyone is fine with it.
I understand where it could annoy people who just want to see a Black Panther versus Namor movie.
Right.
But what is the actor's name who plays Namor?
I've forgotten his name. He's
honestly, he is probably the best thing about this movie.
I agree.
He's really good.
He holds the camera in such a way and has such a charisma about him.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm going to go ahead and give points to costume designers and anybody who was associated with his physical look. He's got a thing where he looks pretty much like classic Namor. They did an amazing job animating the wings.
They made the ankle wings work.
He's the feathered serpent. Yep. He is Kukulkan. Khan.
And they explained why he has the ankle wings. It's like he's the one. He was the first person to have the herb, like, in utero.
Right.
And that's why he's
the first mutant.
He's a mutant.
He's the first mutant.
They called out the mutant thing. I was kind of surprised by that.
Yep.
His name is Tinoch Huerta.
Yeah.
I have never been a big fan of Namor as mutant.
Same.
I'm sort of neither here nor there on it, even in the MCU as yet.
Yeah.
But it's fine, and it's because they did such a good job on him as a character. I can see that this will be interesting, because wherever they take mutants and X-Men stuff, the fact that the first one that people are kind of really aware of
Namor
is a scary guy,
and
might explain a lot of the fear of mutants.
And the other one is Miss Marvel. So in both cases, sort of outsiders.
Yeah.
Which
they're going to be like, oh, it's a Muslim girl and an underwater terrorist man.
It's going to be all people. I think that's deliberate, and I think it's going to be, they're going to be able to make a way, because there's always been that question in the Marvel Universe of, Well, why is everyone scared of mutants, but they're not scared of, like, the Hulk?
Right. Right. They might be scared of the Hulk.
Well, they're scared of the Hulk.
But I know, like, what you mean. Yeah. They're not scared of Cap.
Yeah. Or Thor.
Or Thor. Yeah.
Right. And it was always a little bit dodgy, but it sounds like they're setting up some good stuff with that.
Yeah.
Can we take a minute and talk about Winston Duke?
Oh, man. I wanted a lot more Winston Duke in this movie than we got. He's great in every moment.
But he punctuates every moment.
Yeah, he does.
And I love the thread that makes him basically Shuri's confidant.
The relationship with Shuri is good because, there's a lot of stuff. I'm glad that Ryan Coogler did this because there's a lot of stuff through this where they're referring back to stuff from the first Black Panther. Yeah. There's a lot of lines that are direct, like Winston Duke's character, he refers to, like, you know, she's the girl who doesn't respect tradition, and he refers to that line. Yeah. And the big moment of, like, show him who you are.
Yep.
And there's so many things that resonate with what happened in the first Black Panther. They're, like, direct dialogue things thematically that just really, really works.
But it's interesting that he becomes sort of, like, the voice of reason in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Which was not his role in the first movie.
No.
He was bellicose.
Yeah.
But it's punctuated at the end with him essentially becoming king.
Yeah. Because she doesn't want it. Yeah,
Shuri doesn't care about it. Yeah. She doesn't want that.
Yeah.
And I honestly think that is one of the coolest things, because M'Baku as king in this version, in the MCU, is perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that too.
Yeah,
I think that's really good.
Great.
He's amazing.
The setup they've left here is really interesting. Like, Wakanda and Atlantis and sort of... I wasn't sure how they were going to resolve it. Because they very much were in a war situation. I'm like, are they going to kill Namor? Like, what are they going to do here?
Right.
And the fact that they managed to get to a sort of detente that makes sense, where Namor is scheming.
Was that a satisfying ending for you, though?
I was satisfied with it. Yeah, I've
seen a little grumbling, a little bit. It's not the most amazing ending, because there's a resolution, but there's kind of like you said, it's a detente between two people.
It is detente, yes. I think that's interesting because we don't see that very often.
By the way, in real world, United States and every other major power would be rightly terrified of a pact between these nations and deserve whatever they get.
Well, I think that's what's going to play into Thunderbolts, and I think that's why Julia Louis-Dreyfus is here.
Yeah.
Thunderbolts is going to be the American government's response to superhumans.
Probably.
Because they don't have the Avengers anymore. And the Avengers wasn't American anyway. They don't have S.H.I.E.L.D. So they've got... So Thunderbolts and the agency, which is just the CIA...
I bet we see a variant of S.H.I.E.L.D. I bet we see Hammer. Yeah, or something along those lines. Yeah.
But I think that is the reason why she's here, and that's going to pay off later down the road.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Every scene with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, I enjoyed.
Yeah.
Because she's amazing.
Yeah, she's great. And she's super fun playing that character.
Her take no shit.
Yes.
And scheming.
Fact that she bugged the Kamoyo beads before he even got to them.
Yeah.
Like, that she's been on him the whole time.
Also, not to undercut, Okoye.
Her arc is rough.
The scene with her being sort of dressed down by Angela Bassett.
And the thing is, like, I can understand where both of them are at. Like, I mean, someone points out, she's like, she threatened to kill her own husband for us.
Yeah.
Like she's proven her loyalty. And Ramonda's like, yeah, her loyalty may be great, but all my family's dead because she wasn't able to do her job.
Right.
Yep. And I'm like, man, she's not wrong.
She's not wrong, but I felt...
She's also angry.
Yeah. She was angry. Yeah. She and we just watched Okoye, like,
and you want,
put her
you,
life
you
down.
You want Okoye in that job. Like,
Okoye, and that actress, like, did some emotional work.
Yeah, she did.
Danai Garrett?
Yes.
Yeah.
Also, by
She's
the way,
great.
I don't know I haven't read a lot of the current Black Panther stuff.
Well, those suits
but
that they're
the Midnight
in.
Angel thing is in the very first issue of Ta-Nehisi Coates' run. And it is Io and
They are verbatim from... That is exactly how they look in
like
the comic.
That, yeah.
I was kind of floored by that.
They
I was like,
great.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And just her, like, I don't want to be in a suit. That's stupid.
Yeah. That was fun. I love the Ironheart suit. We finally saw it.
Yeah.
The one that they built in Wakanda was fantastic.
Yeah, it's great.
I'm a little bummed that she didn't get to keep it.
I mean, don't you think it was in the back end of the car?
Maybe. I don't know.
I feel like Shuri's not really going to care about that.
Yeah. And then there's the... Is there anything else before we get to the Stinger? I mean, we didn't talk too much about Namor.
Taylor Khan, I was surprised with it, but it was a wonderfully shot. I thought...
They thought it could use some more lighting.
I was going to say,
yes, more lighting.
Dark.
And that's broadly, I believe, probably an intended aesthetic of the movie that's meant to reflect a somber mood.
Light versus dark, yeah.
But
But yes, like when the camera like travels down there, I wanted the wondrousness to be a little more wondrous.
Yeah, exactly.
And to prop up a DC movie, I wanted the wondrous of Aquaman.
I agree.
And Atlantis. That the way they shot that James Wan shot
that. They could have gotten it.
They could have. I think it just a little too dark.
There is some very neat stuff in there, as we talked about afterwards, Randy, among other things, since it's supposed to be an offshoot of a Mayan civilization.
They were playing that game with the ball.
The basketball sort of thing that, like, you know, anybody who's kind of like seen history special
and
stuff.
And I wanted a little
about.
Bit more with Nimora and Atuma.
I like that Nimora and Atuma are in there, though. I like Atuma as like the military guy who we know in the comics is always trying to overthrow Namor.
Yeah. Yep.
And Namora is his mom in the comics,
right?
And here it's his daughter, which is an interesting take.
Yeah.
But yeah, right. I like that as well. Also, I didn't talk too much about it. The notion that the Wakandans we saw that it, you know the Dora Milaje and all their you know their the war dogs and they have all these factions and that kind of thing. It's clear there's a lot more of that going on in Telecon as well, because they have, like, those siren operatives.
Oh, yeah.
Who, like, that was a cool idea to bring, because that's not from the comics.
Yeah, no, that was a wholly invented cool thing. Yeah, that was, like,
their sonic
it's
weapon.
Their first attack.
They ride on whales.
Yeah.
But the notion of using, like, sort of the myth of the sirens,
that basically,
I thought was very cool.
Yeah, makes you kill yourself, essentially.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting.
It's the equivalent of, like, making sailors crash on the rocks.
Yep.
Yeah, that's cool.
I like their little water breathing technology that they had.
Yeah.
I thought their trick that they were using to Namor to dry him out as their thing. By the way, when she like sets up the flame on him,
that was brutal.
I was like, wow, did they just kill the dude? That was very visceral.
Yeah. Well, same as like one of his wings got.
She
like,
rips his wing off. Torn off. Well, he also stabs her through the guts.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that was neat. It's rare that you see an injury to his leg wing or his ankle wings in the comics.
Yeah.
I can't recall it ever happening. It probably has. I'm sure it has. But I couldn't recall it, so that was pretty dramatic.
Yeah. But then there's the Stinger.
Right. Which, we knew there was only one.
I didn't know that.
Oh, okay. I did going in.
But, I mean, it makes sense, because after that Stinger...
They're not going to do what you... you know, any of those fun Stingers, because that's not the... It would feel like a betrayal of the movie's tone.
You can't follow that tone with a Blarco.
No shawarma. I did cry multiple times in this movie because it was sad. And the Stinger was just like, it hit me.
Yeah, me too. It got me. And the thing is, one of the people who was with us, she was like, I was waiting for that. And I'm like, you were waiting for that? I had no idea that was coming.
Well, we hadn't seen...
Nakia.
Nakia. And they had made a point about saying that she'd never come back to Wakanda.
Yeah.
And I didn't put two and two together.
Well, no, because it's a great magic trick. In one hand, you've got, she lost T'Challa. She lost the love of her life. And so she left Wakanda.
Yeah.
But it turns out there's more to it than that, and that makes sense. By the way, this is another way they can have their cake and eat it, too.
Do we say, the stinger is that she has, that she in private, quietly, had a kid with T'Challa, and they chose to raise him quietly in Haiti, I think.
Yeah.
So that he would be kind of safe from all of the craziness that surrounds
Wakanda. It's why she didn't go to the funeral, because she didn't want people to have to deal with, because she didn't want to
questions. But the queen knew of him.
I thought that was a nice touch. She's like that Ramonda got to meet her. By the way, I understand they wanted to motivate Shuri's revenge. I feel like killing Ramonda was a mistake.
Yeah.
I was waiting for that to reveal that she wasn't actually dead, and then when it was actually that Namor had killed her, because
I was thrown by that.
Because also, that makes Namor a little unforgivable to me. Like, it's one thing for her to have to forgive all the citizens they've killed and all that kind of thing, but he killed her mom.
Right.
Her last remaining family member, and I'm like, to some extent, I understand the message of, we don't want to be in an eternal war, you have to forgive this, but I was like, she deserves his head. Like he has done something unforgivable.
Well,
I can't remember what did he do that how did she die?
He drowned her.
Yeah.
He just straight drowned her?
He drowned her because
he basically destroyed the throne room and caused it to fall into the.
But he didn't like hold her under.
No,
but he did, it was on purpose. He didn't leave until she was dead.
Right.
And the reason he did it is Namor's pride. She did not kill the teenage girl that he wanted her to kill, and therefore he drowned her.
Well, and
that
then,
is fucked up.
And then Nakia killed one of his people.
Yeah. A soldier, but it was like really one of his like children in his mind.
Yeah.
But I'm like,
I don't think this movie ends with Namor as a good person.
No, it definitely doesn't. Like
he is like definitely still scheming, and he is He is going to be an antagonist.
But I think that was my one issue, is that Namor in the comics, while he has been a good guy and a bad guy, he's always somewhat noble. Even though, yes, he did flood all of New York.
I was going to say that was his first thing. He does flood.
But actually, always, I think I would say the one thing that's consistent is his inconsistency in the comics.
But he's been a hero at times.
They mostly have chosen, I would say, at least since the 70s, if not the 80s, if not the 70s, to try and portray him as heroically a troubled anti-hero, but a hero.
He's a heroic a-hole.
And in MCU, he's a villain. Like, I feel like you can't drown Ramonda and then have us ever look at you as a hero.
Yeah.
I feel was a bridge too far for me. And again, it's a weird personal thing. Like, he flooded Wakanda. He killed numerous people. He killed a bunch of soldiers. But those are all... It's kind of like the Joker. We've talked about this before. The Joker can kill hundreds of people. But if he kills Sarah Essen and cripples Barbara Gordon, it becomes unforgivable. When
to use a Star Wars metaphor, Alderaan was just the Empire showing how tough they were. But when Obi-Wan Kenobi dies, you're real sad.
Yeah.
But you're not real sad for Alderaan because you don't know anything about it.
I feel like having him kill Ramonda was a misstep because I feel like, unfortunately, that makes him unforgivable forever.
Yeah.
We'll see.
That is a tough one to, like, say, like, oh, we'll just contextualize it later.
Yeah.
I don't know how you do that.
And you're not wrong. Like, he thought, in his mind, she struck first. She killed one of his. But he had kidnapped her daughter.
Yeah.
Like you can go back and forth, but ultimately Namor was the aggressor on this.
Oh, completely.
And for him to kill her, I think made him... I think that was a step too far. I think they didn't need to do that.
Yeah, I think there was a misstep in the script. I see what they were trying to do.
They wanted to really motivate her toward revenge. But she should already have been motivated toward revenge.
Also, I think... I was trying to figure out, like, what they get from taking her off the playing field, and I think part of it is she is a very effective... She was, like, an effective ruler.
Yes, that's true.
So it forces the next generation to have to step up.
It's true.
Because it's like... It's almost like Angela Bassett is almost, like, too competent. Yeah. Like, you can't imagine that they'd have a lot of trouble when she's running things.
I think that's true.
You think Mbaku's not going to have some trouble?
He's going to have some trouble.
I think you're
right. He's great, but he's going to have some trouble.
I understand the reasoning behind it. I understand why it was done story-wise.
You just would prefer to be able to like Namor a bit more.
I think, unfortunately, what it does to Namor's character, I'm not sure it's worth it.
I like murderers, so I'm okay with it. No, it's going to be one that they'll have to wrestle with a bit. And I think that they probably will. I'll be curious to see. I could see
there being a story arc with a redemption for Namor.
Yeah.
At the moment, he's a villain, but
they managed to make me like, what's he called, Zemo, and he's a terrible person.
It's true.
He killed his
Abomination
dad.
Abomination killed how many people in New York?
Yeah, that's true.
And now he's
But those are all people. They didn't kill anybody we know. I know that's silly, but in fiction, like, if you kill a bunch of nameless people, I can forgive it. But if you kill a person we like, a character we like, you know, in Ant-Man, if someone destroyed San Francisco, we'd be sad and be like, oh, it's a terrible person. But if they killed his cell buddy...
Is it bad that...
we would never forgive that
Ultron character. Killed Quicksilver and I still like Ultron?
Yeah, well, yeah, sure. Quicksilver was boring.
If you're boring, you don't care.
If you're boring, you don't care.
Do you like Ultron as a villain, or you think you want Ultron
more Ultron? Nick thinks robot domination is neat.
I'm just waiting for it to happen.
Oh, it's going to happen.
It's going to happen. any other thoughts? I mean, what I was saying before we got a little sidetracked, but the thing about T'Challa, having a young boy who they've named T'Challa, it lets them have their cake and eat it too, because they gave us Shuri as Black Panther.
Yep.
They didn't recast Boseman.
They mourned Boseman publicly,
in a few years, they will be able to have T'Challa as Black Panther again.
Sure.
And line up with the comics, and it'll be T'Challa's son.
Who's to say we won't have another time jump?
By the way, how do we think that... The kid was like 8 or something.
Seven.
Like,
is he 7?
Okay.
7. Yeah, that means 10 years? He could be like... I was like, that's a little ways out.
It is, but not by Marvel terms. Right. They've already planned like 5 years.
And he could be like a teen hero, depending on what they want to do with him.
Yep, they could do that. Like, let's say Nick could do... Nick said... Secret Wars could definitely give us another time jump.
Yeah.
Well, and you're dealing with Kang, you're dealing with people who can manipulate.
There could be aging stuff, yeah, for sure. They can.
There's so many different ways to go.
If they decide they want to do that. And I have to feel that part of that had to be if Letitia Wright keeps saying crazy anti-vax things, we have a backup plan.
Has she recanted? I think she...
Recant?
I don't know.
Did Disney lawyers step on her and say, look...
I got the impression that they were just kind of like...
Hey, be quiet about it. Yeah, I think that's what I feel like, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
but yeah, but the truth is, I don't know.
I don't either.
I have to devoid myself from
I can't think too much about it.
Like, because I like Shuri as a character, and I thought her character arc worked.
Yeah, it's not like she's a Nazi.
No.
But I really like this, and the more
Randy, what if at the end of the scene where she can't save him, she's like, "If only he hadn't gotten that vaccination."
I think the more I think about this, the more I kind of want to see it again and revisit it. Now that I sort of know the structure of it, I think I would enjoy it differently.
It's probably a good movie to end Phase 4 on, and definitely probably one of the best movies of Phase 4.
I think it's absolutely the best. What's in competition with it?
I mean, I liked all of Phase 4.
I like Phase 4 fine, but like really, I like
Spider-Man Shang-Chi. 3 in Phase 4.
Yeah, Spider-Man Far From counts Home. As Phase 4, and Spider-Man's the best movie in Phase 4.
Easily.
But I feel like it's a Sony movie as much as a Marvel movie, and I don't know if I count it as part of the phase.
I mean, it's part of the MCU.
If you count Spider-Man, I think Spider-Man's better than this. It got me emotionally more than this one did. This one got me emotionally in certain ways, but it was by cheating, by using Chadwick Boseman's death. Spider-Man got me by using nostalgia, which is more acceptable.
Interesting notion.
But what's next for Phase 5? What does it start with?
I don't remember
is it
what's
Ant-Man?
Next. Ant-Man? It's Ant-Man, Quantumania, yeah. Which I'm excited about.
Which seems to be, might be a little more larger than we expect it to be.
Yeah.
I think it's going to pave the way for...
I think we always suspected it was going to have some hidden stuff.
Quantumania involving Kang.
That big things would go down in it. Yeah. But it is interesting to imagine that there will be some... Probably big things we don't
I guess
expect.
I take that back. In a couple weeks, we're going to get the Guardians of the Galaxy
holiday special.
And we're going to see the kidnap of Kevin Bacon.
Yes. I think we would all definitely recommend Wakanda Forever.
Oh, sure. 100%.
Yeah. I guess next week, Nick and I will be talking about Glass Onion. Right?
No, I'm not going to get...
You're not going to see it?
I didn't get tickets.
Oh, okay. Next week, Serena and I will be talking about Glass Onion.
That's possible.
I mean, I'm probably at this
Nick
point...
Nick and I will go out on the sales floor and talk about Andor.
It's true.
And yeah, we probably will talk about Andor wrap-up next week.
Well, the finale is tomorrow.
Tomorrow,
so.
Yeah.
Or tonight, if you're up late enough.
It's one of those rare exceptions where I might, actually, because I'm very excited to see where it ends. I don't know if it ends, because we're definitely getting already season 2.
Are we getting season 2?
Oh, yeah, they're filming right now.
Yeah, that was known, like, from day one. Okay,
it was baked into the premise. It was two 12 episode series.
Okay,
so you're not done hearing how good it is, Randy. Don't you go anywhere.
I don't know.
Have a seat. It's
second
the best
season,
show of the
Second
year.
Season might be more Star Wars-y and less...
No, it's not. It's going to be the same show.
Well, they have to include, like, K2 and...
Sure.
They don't have to.
But
no, they've already
still
said.
Gonna be, it's still going to go through the blender of the show style.
It's going to be K2SO learning how to love. It's going to be something like that, isn't it? It's going to be K2 slowly but surely gaining humanity.
Are you telling me you didn't feel for B?
No, I hate that droid. I hate that droid so much.
Where is your heart, man?
He's a droid.
He just wanted Mama Marva.
Boo. Stuttery droid. I don't care about stuttery droid.
He had to ask Brasso.
That hurts.
He had to ask Brasso to stay with him.
Yes, he was sad.
He's just a robot. They just turn him off.
These are sentient things that have their minds wiped. Mm. That's the sad thing.
Yeah. Randy's got the Han Solo opinion out of it. He's going to wipe him.
Yeah, wipe him.
Oh.
All right, you should wrap up.
Plug him into the Falcon. Take the professor in the back and plug him into the Falcon. All right, yes, let's wrap up for the week. That was our time. We'll be back, in theory, next week with more. Although, again, we may be a little uneven for the next couple weeks because of,
traffic.
We run a store and there might be people.
Yeah.
ruining our podcasting times by, spending money on our store and keeping us in business. But until our next podcast,
Yo Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.